Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Owens Corning of New England, helping homeowners create living space using the Owens Corning basement finishing system for over 20 years. More information at ocboston.com.
Today on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, how young is too young to vote? In her First Amendment as a Congresswoman, Ayanna Pressley introduced a measure that would have lowered the voting age in federal elections to 16. Didn't get enough votes, but it's reviving a debate about who should be eligible to have a say on the issues that are affecting them, from climate change to gun violence to student debt. We'll open the lines and ask you, should 16-year-olds have the right to vote or not?
Then it's time for Better Call Sean. If you've been betrayed by your own bank, bullied by the state, or bamboozled by your local car dealer, and who hasn't? Boston Globe reporter and one-man Consumer Protection Bureau Sean Murphy is here to help. He joins us to talk through his latest cases. At noon, Mayor Marty Walsh is here for this month's edition of Ask the Mayor. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. Wait. You didn't say, it's Friday, and
it's
you usually say on Friday, this is Boston Public Radio live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. And I should say, for people who are here, I am live from the Boston Library, and I'm looking across where you would ordinarily stand.
That's right.
And you apparently are in Brighton. Is that correct?
Well, we've... That's my story, Jim, at least. We've turned the tables. You know how you usually slither around?
I do sometimes.
I am slithering in an undisclosed location right now.
Well, wherever you are, it's great you're there, Marjorie.
Okay,
but she's
you.
Not here,
I'm
but
not.
She's here in voice or something. So in any case, a recent upsurge in youth activism in the U.S., from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas students to the kids pushing for the Green New Deal, has lawmakers revisiting the debate about lowering the voting age. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley is the latest politician to take this on. In her First Amendment as a congresswoman, Pressley introduced a measure that would have lowered the voting age in federal elections from 18 to 16. It fell short, I think it was yesterday, 126 yes, 305 no, with almost every Republican, one exception, and nearly half the Democrats voting against it. Nonetheless, ahead of the 2020 election, does Pressley raise a valid point with issues like gun control, climate change, student loan debt? She says young people aren't just the future, they're the present, and that means they should be voting on the issues that affect them. We're going to open the lines and ask you, where are you on this and why? And if you were against it, as I think Marjorie was, even though I'm not sure why, did the whole Parkland activism situation change your perspective? 877-301-8970. Should 16-year-olds be given the right to vote? What is your position? But I don't even know what your position is.
I don't know. Let me say I'm in flux. I was so impressed by these Parkland...
You're also in Brighton. You're in flux and you're in Brighton.
That's right. True, I'm slithering over here in flux. But the thing, the Parkland kids really opened my eyes to a certain degree. Yeah. They were so engaged, and they're the people that are... in high school, some of them are still in high school, and afraid of what may happen to them with guns. So they were a pretty impressive group. On the other hand, you know, we haven't had a great voter turnout for people between 80 and 30 in years. The 2020 elections, and I mean, excuse me, the 2018 elections were a little bit different. So I don't know. 17 might be easier for me. Just go 1 year down. Because, of course, the reason it went to 18 was Vietnam. And then, of course, you were historic over there in Cambridge.
Because I was historic.
Back in your term on the Cambridge City Council, where you served one term unretired.
Retired undefeated.
Undefeated,
yes,
that's right.
Yes.
I think this was your whole crusade.
It was my whole crusade.
Didn't
It went fine. I sponsored an amendment or a resolution, whatever you want to call it, home rule petition to lower the voting age in school committee elections to 16. It passed, and it only died in the legislature. By the way, while this federal proposal did die, Pressley's proposal, I had a young state rep on TV with me last night who was terrific, who supports this. His name is Andy Vargas from Haverhill. He has sponsored a resolution not that would implement statewide voting by 16-year-olds, but would allow cities and towns to lower the voting age without having to come back to the legislature to get approval, meaning they essentially give approval in advance. And if Brookline or Haverhill or wherever, through their local governing body, wants to say lower the voting age, the age is lowered. So I am I am totally with him. And there, you know, there are a bunch of reasons beyond the Parkland thing. I've always been on board on this thing. Do you know, as a little quiz for you,
yep.
Part of the argument against this, kids' brains aren't, you know, formed in a way to make these kinds of decisions. Do you know, the lawmakers in Massachusetts a few years ago decided that at 14 years old, if you were charged with murder, you have the cognitive something or other that allows, not allows you, that mandates that you be tried as an adult. So you can be tried as an adult on a murder charge at 14, but you're not mature enough to know what the hell is going on to vote in an election at 16. I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that was because of a very extreme crime. And I think a lot of people don't think that was a particularly good idea. I believe that was a Somerville case where the murdered
O'Brien.
The neighbor and stabbed her like 90 times or some gruesome thing
it was
like
horrible.
That. But, you know, the Supreme Court has sort of said, too, that that we shouldn't be holding kids for life or juveniles for life or certainly the death penalty.
Without possibility of parole.
Yes. So there's a debate about this whole thing. I don't know. I'm more flexible on this now, Jim.
Because, you are?
Yes. As you pointed out in your brilliant piece in the Boston Globe, I think that was from
A couple of years ago. Thank you.
The adults haven't really been doing that well.
No, they haven't.
So maybe it's time to open this up to younger people. And in other countries, there's a lot of voting by younger people, too. So this certainly would not be unique.
And speaking of other countries, there's a trickle-up effect. In Denmark, they did a big study on this thing. Mm-hmm. And when young kids, 16, 17-year-olds, are able to vote, you know what happens? Their parents vote at a higher rate than they voted when the kids weren't able to vote. So we want to know what you think. 877-301-8970. The Onion, which is one of our favorite publications, that and Andy Barowitz, gives the pros and cons. You want to hear some of the pros and cons of lowering the voting age?
Certainly.
One of the pros is most teens already have a good sense of which political party their parents told them they're in. And how about this one? It'd be totally hilarious if Ryan ran for, like, controller or something, and the whole school voted for him, and he won. And on the con side, gives kids false hope that their voice will ever matter, and middle-aged politicians will have a legitimate reason to be around more teens. In any case, I think the time has come for this thing. So does Ayanna Pressley, even though her colleagues did not. Hopefully, Beacon Hill will do a little better. By the way, you can drive a car. I would argue the consequences of being a crappy driver are much more significant than the consequences of being a crappy voter, if the concern is that. So I think the time
and
has
the local come. The local stuff with schools is kind of compelling.
Oh, I mean, totally.
That was your idea.
It was my brilliant idea.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
I mean, you're not going to be voting for the school committee in Boston, but you will be voting for school committee in other towns. I mean, that's a reason, I suppose, to get people involved in those school committee meetings at an early age.
Do you remember when those kids confronted Dianne Feinstein the other day, the senator from California?
Yes.
Here's a little bit of this
poor Dianne.
Back and forth where she was, I don't think she was terribly tolerant of their position. Was this on the Green New Deal? I think it was on the Green New Deal.
Yes, it was on the Green New Deal.
Here's a little bit. You'll know which is the teenager and who is the senator. Here it is.
I hear what you're saying, but we're the people who voted you. You're supposed to listen to us. That's your job.
How old are
your
you?
Job.
How old
I'm
are
16.
You?
I can't
well, you didn't vote.
Vote
for me.
Well, she, I'm
it doesn't matter. We're the ones who are going to be impacted.
Mean something.
I love them.
You know,
they're great.
You know, there's another. I mean, if people didn't see this, these young kids, they were very young kids and teenagers, and a whole group of people went in to protest about the Green New Deal, and. This is something that I think, in general, young people are much more upset about because Dianne Feinstein is well into her 80s at this point, even though she's got 7 grandchildren. I mean, she's not going to be around to see her state of California going ever more under the water. Mm-hmm. And young people are really revved up about this. So that might be another reason to think about this in terms of what's going to happen to this planet if we don't start doing something.
You know, it's amazing. I've moved you on tax policy through the years.
Yes, I have.
I have moved you on, or I'm about to move you on young voting.
I don't think you've moved me on tax policy.
What are you talking about? Do you remember the piece you wrote about me and Barbara Anderson in 1990, Marjorie Egan, when I didn't even know you?
Yeah.
Ridiculing my progressive tax stances.
That's right. Because
and now you're leading the charge.
No. Well, that was different because
of course it was.
Barbara Anderson was a very compelling
she was.
Person.
Citizens for Limited Taxation.
Yes, she was.
Yes, she was. Okay. All right, let's take some calls. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Let's start with Nicholas in Providence. Hi, Nicholas.
Hey, Nicholas.
Hi, I'm Colin. I'm a clinician, actually, in Providence, Rhode Island. I work with adolescent girls 16 to 21.
Oh, great. Perfect.
And Yeah, and I was thinking with this too, I really didn't give much thought of it until you guys brought it up, or until hearing about it on NPR and the bill being brought up. But thinking that if this is brought up to kids in 16, where they learn more so how to research it, go into new topics of what's being brought up, bills, local government, and everything like that, they learn how to research it with their teachers and schools, get more interested. Because myself, I'm 28 years old, been voting for about 10 years, and then I really never learned how to research, how to get into the topics on a more formal level. And then sort of I get up there on the bigger topics that make the news and everything like that, but I go on like this half election going in there, and I don't even know half of the local stuff because I honestly didn't know how to research it or didn't know where to go for that information initially. So something like that, to learn how to research it at a younger age, will probably get people more involved to vote more smart.
Sort of an addendum to your point, Nicholas, with which I agree, is most of the research shows that a lot of habits that you develop when you're still living at home and you're 16 or something, you maintain. It might be not smoking because your family doesn't. And voting is the same way. It becomes habitual. And if you can start learning with someone who's voted for a while, go with them, discuss it across the dinner table or on the couch or whatever. They're all starting early creates good habits. And I think most of us agree not enough people vote in this country. So I'm with you. Thank you, Nicholas, for the call. 877-301-8970 is the number.
Paul says, as long as they still don't get a vote on doing their chores while living with their partner at their parents' house, he's all for lowering the voting age, although Art from West Bridgeport doesn't like it at all. He says, lower it. I want to raise it. Since young people seem to be maturing much later than they used to be, 40 would be good. 45 would be better. All this is a ploy to get permanent Democrat high-tax majority because young kids will be propagandized by the public school teachers. Oh, all right. Can we blame this on the teachers? I'm not sure.
You can blame it on the teachers' union, Marjorie. You can do that. It'll make
sure
your
we
day.
Can blame that.
877-301-8970. The time, I really think the time has come. By the way, what was the day when we were talking about, with Mike Estrue, about the 25th Amendment?
Yep.
And we mentioned Jamie Raskin, who is a congressperson from Maryland, who has filed legislation to try to make the 25th Amendment Section 4, if a president is, quote, unable to perform his or her duties, that they can be removed from office. He's from, I think, Tacoma Park, Maryland, which I believe, I hope I got this right, I think I did, when he was a counselor there, city council, that was the first jurisdiction in the United States of America to lower the voting age to 16. So we actually have it in some localities.
Jim.
Already.
How far did you get over there on the Cambridge City Council? Was it a close vote for your proposal?
Oh, how far did I get? I get right to the back room where the free food came from the SNS. Is that what you... Oh, you didn't mean how far did I get?
I wonder if it was like a 5-4 vote.
I don't remember. I think it was 6-3. It did pass, despite the fact that I sponsor. Most things I sponsor were not very popular with my colleagues, even if they liked them content. The fact that I sponsored it didn't help the measure terribly much, but it did pass, and it went to, because it was a home rule petition, which it wouldn't be if Representative Vargas's legislation passed, meaning it would just have become the law for our city. It passed, I think, 6-3, or maybe 5-4, I'm not sure, but it did pass, and it died on Beacon Hill because they never voted on the thing. And by the way, there are a number of jurisdictions, maybe even Brookline, but there are two or three cities and towns in Massachusetts that have sent home rule petitions to Beacon Hill after they've been approved by whatever the local governing body is, and they've all died. None of them have been approved by the men and women up there. Tonya and Lowell, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're
I
excellent.
Love you guys.
Thank you so much. What's up? What do you think?
I am totally against it.
Why?
One, I have three kids of my own, and 16 years old. I think the Parkland kids have made us reassess the mindset of the average 16-year-old.
So.
But what they don't understand is they went through a very traumatic experience, which for anybody, it matures you completely. However, the average 16-year-old, right now they have this challenge on the internet where they're missing for 48 hours on purpose. They're antisocial as ever. I think it would end up hurting us in the long run to lower the voting age.
Well, Tony, even if your analysis, obviously you know your kids, so you're right about them, but even if your generalization about 16 and 17-year-olds is accurate, do you think the average 45-year-old in this country is any better informed or better prepared to vote than your teenage kid is? Because I don't. I mean, based on...
I agree. That's why I agree with the guy who wrote in and said that we should increase the voting age. Like, it's clear that even... That's why they have the drinking age 21. No one has any sense nowadays. I think there should be a complete process. I think it should be as hard to vote as far as not like suppression, but it's hard to vote, or we should have like precursors. Well, did you do this? Did you read that? Like, click this link to make sure you've read this before you can even vote, just to make sure that we have all of the information. Like the guy said, he's voted for things and he didn't even have all of the people participating, what they stand on. We should be required to watch this and watch this debate and read this magazine article or whatever.
Hey,
and
Tonya, how about this? Tonya,
any of that from a 16-year-old, I think, is we're dreaming.
How about even narrowing it more? How about you can start voting when you're 30 and you can't vote after you're 32? So we have a narrow window. Just get in and get out. Hey, Tonya, thanks for your call. Appreciate
you know what the other problem is with this, though?
What?
I mean, lots of us remember when we got our first job, or when your kids got their first job and they were in a state of shock. They thought they were going to get $200 a week or $400 a week. And they didn't realize there was this little issue like taxes, and they weren't going to get anywhere near that because the government was going to take taxes out. Same thing when you buy your first home or your first condo, whatever you buy, and suddenly realize, oh, my God, I got this huge property tax bill. So there's a little issue of kids not really understanding at that age because they're not necessarily taxed to the nines like a lot of other people
so
are.
So why don't you do, I mean this sincerely, I think the perfect transitional phase to see if this is as good an idea as I think it is and Congresswoman Presley thinks it is and you seem to be on the verge of thinking it is, why not let kids vote in local school committee elections if there are, so obviously they don't have them in Boston because they're appointed, see what rate they turn out, see if they seem to know what the issues are. If it works, expand it. If it doesn't work, don't expand it.
Yeah, Brian just from Framingham just said the exact same thing.
You did?
Yeah, everybody wants something for free as long as they don't have to pay for it. And once you start getting your tax bills, then you understand how expensive things are. I mean, that is a great point.
It is?
Yes.
Okay.
Brian and I made it beautifully, I think.
877-301-8900. Let's go to North Attleboro. We're talking about lowering the voting age. Ayanna Pressley wanted to do it on the federal level. It was defeated yesterday, her proposal. And Representative Vargas from Haverhill wants cities and towns to be able to lower the voting age in Massachusetts, should they choose. Catherine in North Attleboro, you're next. Hi.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
We're good.
I just wanted to say, Jim, couldn't agree with you more on the statements that you've been making, but I am a full proponent of lowering the voting age. I have worked with teens for the bulk of my career with a nonprofit organization, and I also majored in youth development in college.
Oh, great.
These teens, young adults, are going to be faced with, you know, the ability to take out tens of thousands of dollars in student loan debt to go to school, but no part in having representation on education reform.
Absolutely.
And I also just wanted to mention that adultism is a form of ageism, and it is wild how many people believe that their experience and their level of experience now is the only level of experience that you should be able to have to vote. To say that now that I'm 40, only 40-year-olds should be able to vote because the rest of them don't know what they're doing. They're all just kids.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, Catherine, a lot of us don't know what we're doing either. You know, how many times have you gone into the voting booth, and there's, especially on the town level, if you're not involved in your city or town, and you look at these people, I mean, who knows who their governor's counselor is? Who knows what the governor's counselor does? Who recognizes it? Or registrar of deeds? I mean, a lot of us are really up to speed on the registrar of deeds. It's really a problem in general, right?
Yeah, but I would also argue that, you know, when you look at 16 and 17-year-olds and having the ability to become civically engaged and adults recognize in them for the first time that they have enough intelligence
and enough thought to be able to
engage in that, I really think you're going to see young people become a lot more empowered at the voting booth, and hopefully for it to be a trend for young people to continue to become engaged.
Well, you know, Catherine, thanks for the call. On that note, a friend of ours, Alan Salamont, who is the former treasurer of the Democratic National Committee, former ambassador to Spain, and now he's at Tufts, gave Marjorie and me, remember Marjorie a couple of weeks ago, some data that they had pulled together on voting by 18 to 29-year-olds.
Yep, it was much bigger.
And from 2016 to 2018 alone, one election cycle, it went from 21% to 31%, a 50% increase in turnout just in that one election. Now, you mentioned, Marjorie, people not knowing what they're doing. I don't know if I ever told you, I knew somebody who went to the polls in her hometown.
Mm-hmm.
She went to the wrong location on the wrong day.
Uh-huh.
Can you imagine anybody? Do you know that person?
I did that.
It was you.
Yeah.
That's
right. Well, I'm a disorganized person, Jim.
I
went back and I finally got to the right place.
Okay. Yeah.
I think I did. Maybe I just missed it.
I doubt
it.
That. But in light of the fact that I outed you, I went out myself. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned this before. I am totally in favor of abolishing the Governor's Council, which no one even knows what it is. It's eight people, who you never heard of, who make decisions about parole and judges and that sort of thing. I cannot tell a lie. Two election cycles ago, I was not going to vote because I didn't know who the person was who was running. And I think I told you this, as I'm entering the polling place in my neighborhood at Inman Square, I bump into this young woman, and it turns out, and she's talking to me, and she did a really impressive job. It turns out she was the daughter of the guy who was running, and I voted for him. And I'd like to say, and I think it's partially true, she convinced me that he knew what he was doing and was competent, but it was in part because she was really engaging and smart and did a terrific job on behalf of her father, which I guess is not a terrific reason to be voting for somebody.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of obscure people in obscure positions on the ballot, and I think it's you got to really be an engaged citizen to keep up on who's doing what and whom you should vote for in the Governor's Council. I mean, I just leave it blank because there was only one person I knew in the Governor's Council, and she was the person that got in trouble.
The hairdryer?
I think she went after somebody with a curling iron or something.
Do you remember after we talked about her on the air, she called in that day at her old radio station.
Well, she was very sorry she did it.
She didn't.
I think she lost her temper at the hairdressers or something like that. Anyway, let's go to Dave from Dedham. Hi, Dave.
Then we got to take a break. Yeah, hi, Dave.
Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I'd like to point out that liberals are not leading the charge on this because it's the right thing to do. They're doing it because they know that it will result in more liberal voters. And that's the same thing liberals do most things, like illegal immigration. They're letting people in by the score because they know they'll support the Democrat Party.
First of all, it's the Democratic Party. I don't know if you're aware the name is the Democratic Party.
The people that come in here that aren't legal, they can't vote. You know that.
Can we keep it? Well, they will. That's the thing. It's the long term. Let's keep it with the children, okay? They want children to vote because they know that they're going to vote for the Democrat Party.
Dave, can I tell you something? That argument is as pathetic as the reason Republicans deny the franchise to the people who live in Washington, D.C., because Republicans, when they're as candid as you are, say, we don't want all those black people to vote because we know they're all going to vote for Democrats. So the argument there is just as nauseating, frankly, as yours. But thank you for the call. I mean, the notion that we shouldn't enfranchise somebody. It's fine to say young kids shouldn't have the vote because they're not qualified or they don't have the education or whatever the hell it is, the cognitive abilities. But to argue that the only reason people are advocating for it is because they think they're going to vote a certain way is so incredibly disrespectful of the constituency that people are talking about. If you don't like it on the merits, Dave, argue against it on the merits. I mean, it just drives me nuts. The D.C. argument really drives me nuts. The fact that, I mean, it's just insane. In any case, we got to take a break.
Jim Browdy's revved up.
I'm sort of revved up.
Talking about lowering the voting age ahead of the 2020 elections. Is it time to get younger people to the polls to vote on issues that affect them? The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH. Jim is at the Boston Public Library.
Live. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We are live. Actually, we are not live. I am live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Marjorie, for some reason, is at our studio in Brighton. Our next guest, Sean Murphy from The Globe, is here, and he's looking around like, where the hell is Marjorie? Which is a very good question.
Well, I'm glad he misses me.
If you're just tuning in,
yep.
Hi, Sean.
She says hi.
We're talking about lowering the voting age. Ayanna Pressley introduced a measure to lower to 16 federally. It was defeated. She said young people are at the forefront of some of the most existential crises. We're taking your calls asking you, is she right? A couple of years ago on the radio, we asked Governor Baker what he thought about this thing, and here's what the governor said to us. I was 16 once. I had three 16-year-olds. I'm not sure that's such a good idea. I think 18 is just fine. 877-301-8970. Let's go
to Diane in Fairhaven. Hi, Diane.
Hello, Diane.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, I'm a frequent caller. I love you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And my son and I were there in the studio a couple of weeks ago. Anyway,
oh, great.
My other son, when he was 18 and so was his posse, they thought it was great fun to vote for Trump just because they were a bunch of wise asses. Mm. So, 16-year-old should not, no way. And I'm very engaged in my little town. I'm a town meeting member. I've gotten them to go to a high school occasionally and do a town meeting. I mean, not a town meeting, but a school committee meeting at the high school. I've done a get out the vote thing at the high school. And it's simply to engage them in our local government. But the wise asses wanted to vote for Trump. So,
hey, Diane, do you think if 16 is too young, is 18, based on your experience with your kid, is 18 too young, too, in your perspective? Should it be 21, like the drinking age?
Well, I believe everything should be 21, even getting drafted. Yeah. So if you can go into service and or get drafted, which is a possibility this day and age, no, you can vote. So I just don't think, you know, I just think really everything should be 21. There's studies out there about the undeveloped brain of children that age, and they are children still. Well, that's my...
Diane, we appreciate it.
Hold on,
sorry,
Diane, before
Margaret.
I go, just a quick question. So 2 years later, are they still thinking it's a joke, or are they more serious about their voting, or what?
They're more serious because I sat down and had a talk with them, just like I do all kinds of topics when they're at my house.
Okay. Don't think it's a joke anymore. Thank you.
Thanks. You know, by the way, the one thing I do have sympathy for, I'm not sure 21, I think... All of these age things are arbitrary. There's not a draft, obviously, people know. The age you can enlist in the military, the age you can drive a car, 16. The age in Massachusetts you must be tried as an adult for a capital offense, 14. The age you can drink, 21, vote, 18. There is some argument to be made, even though I guess there are different skills in each. Wouldn't it be simpler if our legislators decided that there was an across-the-board age at which point you could do everything, sort of the entry point, 18, 19? Wouldn't that make more sense?
Well, I've said before, I think the drinking age should be 18 because I think it's what we created is this hide-in-the-closet and do jello shots mentality at colleges where you can't go out and drink in a normal way.
Do you remember the Amethyst Initiative started out of Middlebury College?
Yeah. I mean, it's a real problem, I think, in colleges. And remember, everything was 18 for a while during Vietnam. Yeah. Then it went back up to 21 for drinking and stayed the same for voting in most places anyway. Can we squeeze in one more call?
By the way, it was Vietnam. You know, I opened my piece in the Globe magazine, Old Enough to Fight, Old Enough to Vote.
Right.
That was the case in 1971 to lower the voting age 18. By the way, I shouldn't have mentioned it without explaining. The Amethyst Initiative was started by the president of Middlebury College years ago and signed on to by hundreds of college presidents, provosts, leaders, deans, which argued for what exactly Marjorie did for the exact same reason, lowering the drinking age. This is on college leaders to 18.
Hey, Kate's got a good point. She says, how can we constitutionally withhold income tax if a 16-year-old... Basically, she's saying taxation without representation. She's saying that these kids get taxes taken out of their paychecks, but they're not allowed to vote, so maybe it should go to the Supreme Court, Jim.
How about D.C., as I just said? We have time for one more call, Marjorie.
Let's go to Will in Newton. Hi, Will.
Hi, Will.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So I got a few thoughts on this.
Sure.
You know, starting off with maybe there should be a 3/5 kind of compromise for these kids to let them get a little bit of a vote in there.
Well, I think we did that once, didn't we?
Yeah.
Didn't work out so well, but go ahead.
That aside, I believe that everybody should have a vote, from the day you're born. And if your vote gets cast by your parents until you're 16, and then there's an option for you to start taking over for that vote, maybe 14, whatever, that sounds wonderful to me because you do live in this country. You should be able to vote. Like, the decisions made by by our government affect you just as much as anybody else.
Will, do you know there's a movement? Do you know there's a movement, the name of which I don't recall, which says that your vote should be a function of your family size for exactly the reason you mentioned? That if you have minors in your family, but you have six people in your family, as opposed to a single person, that single mother with four kids or whatever it is should have more of a vote because they are more of a constituency. They're impacted in a more extreme way. So actually, there are a lot of people who share your vision on this. Thanks for the call, Will. We appreciate it.
Okay, we are done. Thank you very much.
We're not done. We're done with this.
We're done with this. Yeah, we're moving on because we're going to talk to Sean Murphy.
We are.
It is time for a Better Call Sean, the Boston Globe's intrepid consumer protections reporter who's got all these great stories about people getting the shaft. And then he attempts to solve those problems. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He and Jim are live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. I am live from our GBH studio here. She is in Brighton for reasons no one quite understands. Even though the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been gutted, we still have some protections thanks to Sean Murphy. Sean's a Boston Globe reporter, the man behind the fine print column, which takes on some of the toughest consumer predicaments and attempts to solve them, often doing just that. Sean, it's good to see you.
Hi, Jim.
You are my hero, Sean Murphy. Let me tell you, I read these stories. I get so excited.
After your column today in the Globe, Marjorie, you're my hero.
You are
a rascal writing that.
I should pump my own column.
Why don't you mention what it is, Marjorie?
Yeah, basically, I had talked about how I have this fantasy of Jared, Ivanka, and Don Jr. in orange jumpsuits. And I wrote about that. And I'm not the only one, Sean, who has that fantasy.
No, you've got a lot of good people chiming in with you.
That's right.
Michael McCormick.
That's right. Michael McCormick, the former city councilor in Boston. That's absolutely right. He's a very funny guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. So anyway, Sean Murphy, this is another great story.
Yes,
so there's this beautiful swank restaurant, been kind of the high end. You know, if you went to go to L'Espalier, you were really something. So what happened with L'Espalier and the gift cards?
Well, I don't know if I updated it last time, but the restaurant closed rather abruptly with only a week's notice. And there were dozens, if not hundreds of people with gift cards with value still on it. And they couldn't get refunds for, in some cases, up to $500 on a card. So I wrote the story, and they had a big PR firm call me, and they said they're going to try to do something. The Attorney General's office... wisely and laudably jumped in and said, we're going to do something here. And I've actually just got off the phone earlier this morning anticipating this question. And they're coming to terms. There was actually going to be some refunds for these dozens or scores of people who have some credit left on gift cards to L'Espalier so that they'll get their money back.
Can you talk about gift cards in general, what the rules are? Are they allowed to have expiration dates in this state?
Yes, and in Massachusetts, there's only one narrow stricture. And that says if you have a gift card, it can't expire any time sooner than 7 years. So in other words, the consumer gets to have 6 years, 11 months, et cetera, before it'll actually
expire.
But
and it has the state, I assume it would have to state that on the card, that they can't just
I'm not quite sure. I've seen the back of the cards, but I'm not sure if it says that, but it is law. If you have a gift card, hold on to it and use it within 7 years.
By the way, the L'Espalier was right down the street from where we are as we speak. Didn't in your piece, I read it a couple of days ago, didn't L'Espalier, before they agreed to this restitution thing or whatever they've agreed to, thanks to
grudgingly.
The Attorney General, didn't they offer somebody you wrote
raw
meat?
Yeah.
What did they offer?
Well, these people were people with
yourself?
The cards. They found out that it's going to close in a week, and so they called and they tried to get reservations in those last days, but it was all booked. It was a horror show. And one of the people there, one of the managers, was saying, "Well, we'll give you a nice piece of London broil,
uncooked.
You can carry it out with you, you know, or tea, or you know, they were giving their plants anything to make them go away." And that's really not what these people had in mind.
Okay, so another thing where I think there's a universal concern or cluelessness or whatever is a fake check. You check your account, which I do every day. Marjorie does about once every 10 years, I would guess.
Well, wait a minute, Jim. You told me that you were charged for some service. I think it was your iPad, $9 a month.
Yeah, and you refused to take the damn case. You argued against me on the
enough,
air.
But you
that
didn't even
really
check
helpful.
It. You didn't even know you were getting
for
charged.
For years.
Okay. So
I was paying $80 a month for four iPads.
Oh, that's
awful. For like 3 or 4 years.
And they gave you nothing.
Excuse me. And who didn't help me? Sean Murphy, the consumer's
Let me take that under consideration.
Okay, thank you. So describe this. I mean, occasionally it happens to us. You go on your account online or you get your statement. And you see it's got less dough than you knew you had.
This guy's down about zero. And he had $9,000, so he quickly calls up a photocopy of his check, and he sees that it's somebody else's signature. The date on, or the street address on the check is wrong. It's not his. The Citizens Bank logo's missing. It's obviously a fabricated forgery. And so he calls. He runs right down to the branch office, and he says. you've got to refund me this, $9,000. They say, oh, yeah, we'll look into it. Give us 2 weeks. And 2 weeks turns into a month, turns into 2 months and beyond, and he still has got nothing, no satisfaction. So that's when he called Sean.
That would be you, by the way. Yeah, thank you. Referring to himself.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're trying to develop this brand. You got to call Sean.
That's
here.
Right.
I'll take it, but, you know. I just want to go with the flow here.
Okay, and what happened?
And so, you know, in half the cases I do, we get what I call pre-publication restitution or resolution.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is what's happened. The next day, he gets a call from the bank, and they say, well, refund it. You'll have it in your checking account tomorrow. And they did.
But there's Mark.
Oh, okay. All right. You go ahead. Then I got to tell you a story.
Just like the gift card thing where there are issues that go beyond the individual person who was screwed or potentially screwed, who you're dealing with. Who is responsible? I mean, where is the responsibility?
Well, the theme here is the party that is in the best position to ferret out the fraud and doesn't is held responsible. So if the check is brought to the depository bank, and the depository bank doesn't know who it's dealing with. They're at risk. If the bank is presented, the check presented by the depository bank to the drawer bank, and the drawer bank
Citizens
doesn't check the signature of the customer against the signature card, they have exposure.
Well, that makes me nervous, though, because wait a second. I worry that a bank might say, well, the person, this getting back to my Verizon problem, which you didn't help me with, is the bank might argue the person who should have known this first is you should have known when your balance was $9,000 and it went down to $10, you should have told us right away.
He did. He did that without
an hour. But what if you don't right away?
If you don't, then you're leaving yourself exposed.
So you got to do checking.
So he got the money restored. If you're on your checking account, just keep up to date with it. Do not leave your checkbook out in the public somewhere. Be a little bit sensible.
When was the last time you checked your checking account online?
I check my checking account a lot online.
You do?
Yes, I do. I do. Because I'm always worried about my debit card getting stolen or something like that, so I do check it.
And credit cards, you should do that, too.
You know what's another moral of this story, too? I had a terrible situation with Citizens Bank, and they're a big bank. And you go to the corporate offices in Rhode Island, and some kid calls you up on the phone. And he's absolutely couldn't be a bigger jerk. And I, of course, took my vast fortune out of Citizens Bank after this happened and took my mortgage someplace else. But the difference between a big bank and Citizens Bank and a little bank like the place I've banked for years, the Tremont Credit Union, or now I'm at Brookline Bank, it's night and day. I, at least that's been my experience. As someone, you know, they just don't care because they're huge and they don't have to care.
Do you remember, on that note, by the way, we can say it now because they're not our sponsor anymore. One of our big sponsors, we're in commercial radio, was Century Bank, largest family-owned bank.
That's another nice bank.
And, you know, every time we had a sponsor, the way I know this is only anecdotal, if people had a problem with the product or the service, we'd get deluged. We never got one complaint, and it's in part because it's a smaller bank that's family-owned. I am totally with it. Do you buy that notion?
Yeah, somewhat. Banks have good days and bad days. They have good periods of management and bad periods. The thing that you can do, and only you can do, is watch out for yourself by checking your accounts and flagging anything that is irregular. And just being responsive.
Why didn't you write in your column that I should be checking my Verizon account to see if
I use you as the example of what not to do. Yeah.
I was very happy, Sean, that you went after Citizens Bank because they deserved it, and I'm glad you got them stuck there. But let's move on to something else that everybody can relate to. This is sort of your biggest fear, that you go to buy a used car.
Absolutely, it
and
is.
And you drive three blocks down the street.
Three blocks.
And the transmission falls out the bottom. Yeah. That's not exactly what happened to your person, but it's close.
No, that happened, and the air conditioning went crazy, too. And
Three blocks.
Three
blocks. Attleboro. Old school auto sales. Young guy, 18 years old. He's with his father. He's out. The first vehicle he's ever owned. He's got a new job as an electrician's apprentice. He's all gunned up, ready to go. He paid decent money, $3,500 for the vehicle, and it breaks down. They get it towed back, and the salesperson immediately starts to make promises. Oh, we're going to get it fixed. And he said, no, I don't want this car. I don't have any faith in it. So he wants a refund. It drags out 6 months, and they're just playing him around. They kept telling him, "Oh, you got to talk to the owner,"
months.
And then
six
the owner
months.
Was never available. 6 months later.
So enter Sean.
And then
better call Sean.
Better call Sean.
My apologies.
Yeah, no.
What happened?
So I went down there, and I present myself. I just want to know what's going on. This woman comes out. What's your name, Kim? What's your last name? I'm not going to tell you.
I love that. You know?
I said, well,
that's
what happened to the vehicle?
Sign, don't you think?
It is. So I said, well, what happened to the vehicle? He says it broke down in three blocks away. And she says, yeah, it did. It broke. I said, well, what happened? She said, I don't know. But then she accused him of going out there and doing donuts.
Explain what a donut is.
Usually you do it on an inch of fresh snow. Where you're just in a parking lot with no vehicles. You just pull the steering wheel hard on one end, gas it up, and you just spin around. But with his father, it just doesn't make sense. He said, no, it never happened.
And so what happened?
So, I write the story, they get a lot of pressure. In fact, he's part of Local 103, which is a very politically active electricians union. He's in the apprentice program, which is a very prestigious, competitive thing, and had to work hard to get into there. Graduated with honors from a vocational high school. All the guys there and those women too who are in the union began emailing the place.
Oh, I love it.
And barraged them. And pretty soon they're begging him, "Come on down and get your check. We got a check for you. Make it stop." And so he turned the tables on him, and he got a full refund.
You know what bothers me about these stories, though, and I love what you're doing there. We're talking to Sean Murphy, who's the consumer guy at the Boston Globe.
I think I know what you're going to say.
What?
Oh, well, it's you could only champion one person at a time.
That's half. I've said that before. I have something new to say. It drives me nuts when someone has wronged somebody else, and thanks to outside pressure from you or fellow union members,
they don't get any
the ultimate outcome is they end up where they should have been. In the first place.
Well, there is some bad publicity, believe
well,
me.
Well, that's well, actually, that's a very good
that's
point.
That's
a big
thing,
yeah. That's a very
good
point.
That's why this auto company, they were aghast.
What's the name of the place?
Old School Auto Sales.
Where is it?
Attleboro, Massachusetts.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Marjorie, you were going to say
something.
Well,
what I was going to say is that it just shows how many unscrupulous people there are, that just give people the shaft and well, most people have no recourse, really,
Yeah.
I mean, you can call the Attorney General's office. You can call the Better Business Bureau, I suppose.
Well, the more people that, frankly, I'm going to plug the column a little bit here, the more people that plug into it, that read it, that make comments, the more might we have
That's
as
right.
consumers.
How do they reach out to you, Sean Murphy?
Most of them come by email, which is Sean, S-E-A-N dot Murphy at globe.com. And I sift through them. And the more might we have, the more people feel deterred. I have people call every once in a while or email and say, "Oh, I invoked your name, and I got the result I wanted."
I love it.
That's pretty.
That's right. You should be kind of like the Mount Everest of consumer reporters out there. We're going to do everything we can to make you.
You haven't asked about the kid with the lacrosse helmet.
I am going to ask. What are you running the show? Or we're running the show. Yeah, well, I haven't asked about. Okay. By the way, there's no problem too small for you. I read this thing, and while I was sympathetic, well, tell the underlying story before you tell the outcome.
Okay, here's this wonderful young man, 18. He's a high school all-star lacrosse goalie.
Yeah.
Gets recruited to Wheaton College, which is Division III. It's not the big sports atmosphere, but he wants to play, of course. He goes to suit up, and his head happens to be 25-inch circumference, and they don't have a helmet big enough to fit him. He, his coaches, some people that support him, like
let me just be clear here. So wait a second. So you have somebody, a fellow media member, who's getting screwed by Verizon over four years.
Yeah. And
his problem is
not worth
dealing with. But a guy whose head is too big for a lacrosse helmet,
his problem is worth dealing with? He earned it. He's an innocent party.
Okay,
his hands are clean.
And
completely.
Many of us have big heads. Did you know that the Irish have big heads, Sean Murphy?
I'm not Irish, and I have a big head too, Margaret.
Yeah.
So go ahead. So what happened to the kid?
So his mother and his coaches are campaigning for him for month after month. They have to go to these two major manufacturers of sporting goods to say, we need a custom-made, we need a bigger helmet. And they couldn't be bothered because there's no profit in it on a one-time deal. Yet they did a custom helmet for a Division I best player in the country at the University of Albany. So the piece goes, and this is a post-publication resolution where it takes a couple of days, and then suddenly the manufacturer, in this case Cascade, steps forward and says, we got a helmet.
I love that, actually. Yeah. It's pretty great.
Yeah. And in the course of this, what was really kind of nice was the byproduct was I got a tremendous amount of emails, including those from former lacrosse players who happened to have had big heads, probably Irish, Marjorie.
Exactly.
Had big helmets in their attics or garages or whatever. At least two of them actually hand-delivered or mailed larger helmets to Alex Chu to see if it would fit.
So you wanted us to ask you the question, give us the update on the lacrosse helmet story. The update that I am dying for, and you have to tell the underlying story if people didn't hear that story last month. Talk about the Salem Cat Woman.
Oh, the cat lady.
This was one of the great injustices of all time. Again, resolved. Tell the story and then tell the resolution, please, Sean.
This got a huge amount of response, more than any of the, 75 I've done so far. A woman adopts a cat from a shelter. A cat had been abused. And this woman, Pamela Howard, brings it home, and she's a lovely cat owner. The terms of the adoption required that the cat be indoors only for its own safety, which is not uncommon. It's actually recommended by all cat people. She takes, in the course of a particular day, she happens to take the cat outside on a leash for a minute and took a little Facebook video of it and posted it. The owner of the adoption agency sees the video, calls her, and sues her, takes her into court, files a lawsuit against her to take the cat back for breach of contract.
Didn't she spend thousands of dollars?
And poor Pamela, who's this, nice woman, loves her cat. She's faced with this person coming after her with a lawsuit and a private attorney. And she herself then has to get lawyered up to the tune of $3,000. But she loves the cat, and she feels like she's honor-bound to protect this cat, and does. And it goes to court. It gets tossed out on a technicality. And the adoption agency person continues to threaten to go to the court of a higher court. And that's when the piece ran. And people were outraged. And even this adoption agency's own lawyer was kind of saying, gee, I think we probably do have a good owner here. Maybe this isn't the right path to follow.
But, this is another good example. These cat adoption agencies, I know they're doing good things. This woman was not made whole. Thanks to you, she gets to keep her cat, which I'm sure is her primary concern. But how grotesque is it that they sued her and she loses $3,000? The good news is she gets to keep what she really cares about.
Right.
Her
cat. She also
they should at least give her $1,500
or something. For the rest of her life, she's a hero in many people's books.
True.
She's got the glow of having done the right
she
thing.
Does.
And that was a difficult choice, $3,000 or give it up, and she'd make the right choice.
Did you meet the cat?
I definitely met.
What'd you think of the cat?
It's a beautiful cat, blue eyes, Siamese.
Yeah.
I'm allergic
good
to cats.
Good personality, good thing?
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, really.
We're talking to Sean Murphy. I mean, you have a lot of good resolutions here.
I'm doing pretty good so far.
What's your percentage, do you know?
I don't want to brag or anything.
Well, go ahead. What is it? Do you have any idea?
Well, of the seven so far this year, we're 7-7.
We are?
Yeah, I am. You are. Oh,
that's why he's my hero,
yeah, no,
Jim.
So we got three pre-publication, three post. And then we got Les Paillet, which is in the works.
So do you hope, I mean, I know your stated goal is resolution, is satisfaction for the consumer, but are you upset when you have a great story and you get the evildoer to do the right thing before you go to publication? Because it sort of
screws
your whole
thing. That's a good question.
It's
funny. My editor, Patty, it kind of frustrates her a little bit, you know, because in the news media, we want to show... As we used to say, the Globe gets results. What was it? Globe gets results, yeah. Globe gets action. That's what we used to say. But for me, if you know, I usually hold on to the resolution to the end of the piece, so you don't know necessarily. It gets you to read it to the end.
Yeah.
I don't hit you over the head with a result. Right,
what do you call them? Little updates? What do you call that thing?
Updates, sort of thing.
So, okay. Well, that's really, it's spectacular. I mean, you're really doing great. So tell us what, are you allowed to tell us what you're working on now? I can't remember.
Well,
you're not
I'll hint
to do that.
At one. There's one, this Go guy ahead. Is paying with his son for his student loan. And the terms of the loan says that after 48 consecutive timely payments, the parent can be released as a cosigner.
Cosigner, yeah.
Yeah. And so the guy does this, and he says, all right, time's due. He goes to the American Education Services, which manages it, and says, all right, I should be released. And they said, well, no. Back in October 2015, there's no payment showing for October. And upon closer examination, that's because the October payment, due October 3rd, was paid on September
30. Ooh.
Early.
Well, don't give away the outcome. You do that next
okay.
one. Can I give you a quick problem? We only have 30 seconds. As a member of the public, it's not my Verizon thing, there was this big-time criminal who was sentenced to only 47 months.
I heard
and
about
I
him.
Think it was unjust.
Yeah.
And he should be sentenced to much more.
Yeah, well, he only beat the government of $6 million.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Hey, okay. Sean, it's great to talk
okay,
to you.
Okay, Sean... Sean.Murphy@globe.com.
That's right.
Send me something. I read them all. I sift through them. I respond.
Great.
And I pick those that I think are the most compelling and most outrageous.
Sean.Murphy@globe.com.
Thank
Use
you, Jim.
Thank
you.
Hero, thank you very much for joining us today. Coming up, Mayor Marty Walsh is here to take our questions and yours. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio at the Boston Public Library.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. At noon, Mayor Marty Walsh is here to take our questions about the search for a new Boston Public School superintendent, his transportation improvement plan, which includes a 20-mile-per-hour speed limit, and how he feels about a new study that says Suffolk County is the most politically intolerant one in the nation. We'll also, of course, take your questions and calls on this month's edition of Ask the Mayor.
Callie Crossley joins us to once again dash Jim's dreams of Michelle Obama, Donald Trump presidential face-off. The New Yorker staff writer Patrick Braddon Keyes is here to talk about his new book, which solves the murder of Jean McConville, a 38-year-old mother of 10 living in Belfast. And along the way, he writes about IRA atrocities and the enduring toll that the Troubles have taken on Northern Ireland. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hour number two. Hello again, Jim.
Hi, I'm at the library.
Yep.
Marjorie is trying to figure out how to explain this. She's in Brighton. We have no idea why,
yep.
But she is.
I'm there.
In any case, the mayor will be here in about 30 seconds. His car just arrived. Marjorie, White House Communications Director Bill Shine, one of your favorite people, has resigned to work on the 2020 reelection campaign. You want to tell people a little background on Shine and why you're not a huge fan?
Well, Shine had to leave Fox News after many years there because he apparently covered up and made it very difficult for women to press charges of sexual harassment against both Bill O'Reilly, who cost the company millions and millions of dollars in settlements, and Roger Ailes, who cost the company millions and millions in settlements he used to run Fox News. That's Roger Ailes. He created Fox News. So I thought it was an odd situation that a man fired for basically condoning the sexual harassment and, in some cases, assault of women would be hired by the White House to be the communications director. But he was.
Yeah, I just saw this a couple of minutes ago on CNN. We don't know what the backstory is here. I mean, I don't know if this is just like a soft out where he's able to go, allegedly go to the reelection campaign, or Trump was unhappy with him. I don't know what the deal was. You don't know any more about it right now, do you, or do you?
No, but I know that the Jane Mayer piece in The New Yorker is getting huge amounts of play because it talks about this sort of revolving door situation between the White House and Fox News, where even many people, like John Bolton was a commentator on Fox News, and then he's at the White House, and the guy over at HUD that was, you know, on Fox News, now he's at the White House. So there's been a lot of back and forth, and it just looks... It's a very bad week for Fox News.
So, Marjorie, the mayor of the city of Boston just arrived, mm-hmm. and I think you, in your own words, should explain, because he's looking in your direction.
Is she?
Where is she? He just said,
where
can you explain where you are and why?
This disembodied voice coming to you from afar, Mr. Mayor.
I miss you.
She's
thank
in
you
Brighton.
Very much.
We have no, don't even, don't, please do me a favor, don't ask.
I'm nice stuck with Jim here, and I don't
you
have
are.
You.
Nice to see
oh
you,
my
Mr.
God.
Mayor. How
and
are
what's
you?
Really upsetting is we're going to get donuts later in the show, and I won't be there to get the donuts when they show up for the news quiz.
I'm upset because I can't peek at your papers and see what you're going to ask me.
That's
you can
right.
peek at mine, my friend. Good to see you, Mr. Mayor. Thanks for coming.
Great to see you.
By the way, if you want to talk to the mayor, and I'm sure you do, his number is 877-301-8970, or you can send them an email at bprwgbh.org, or you can tweet us at BOS Public Radio. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
That's okay. That's okay. Well, Mr. Mayor, I'm sorry to start on a sad note, but as you well know, there's been two 23-year-old women who were kidnapped after nights out at Boston bars. Jessica Ray, a 23-year-old mother, was murdered, and another woman, gratefully, was rescued by the Boston police through videos and through pings on her cell phone. But I know that you're taking some action regarding what's going on with these bars downtown. What's happening?
Well, first of all, I just want to publicly, I've already done this, but to the Correa family, pass along our condolences from the city of Boston. I was with them last night. There was a vigil in Dorchester, and tonight there's a wake at St. Peter's Church and a funeral tomorrow. So very sad situation for Jesse's mom and dad and brother and daughter, and it just in the whole community in Boston, and even particularly the Cape Verdean community, people have taken this very, very tough, and I want to just pass along our condolences. Next week, we're going to have a meeting, the Boston Police Department, our city's licensing board, with licensed premises in Boston, on the safety and well-being of their patrons. And they're working on an agenda now just to make sure that as people are leaving the bar, some people leave intoxicated, and making sure that they're safe, looking at opportunities for, some of these clubs have cameras that take pictures of licenses when they come in, just to have them on staff. They have cameras there. And we're just going to be talking to them about some different safety procedures we can put in place. I don't think it's a coincidence that we've had two women abducted in a bar, and people preying on young women and people coming out of a bar that might be intoxicated. So we're going to be having those meetings next week to talk about how do we try and improve the safety both inside the club but also leaving the club.
What do you recommend, though, Mr. Mayor? I know that what is the commissioner going to say to a bar owner? You have Jane Doe, who's leaving your bar. She obviously is, in your estimation or your bartender's estimation, you've had more than she probably should to be walking home or walking in her car. What do you do?
It's hard. It's complicated. I think in these cases, and I'm not going to put all the facts out there, but in the case of Hennessy's, the young woman left the bar, and I think there was a it was several blocks away where this abduction happened. Mm-hmm. In the case of Jesse, I think it was a little different, but it is complicated. But I think it's more kind of keeping eyes on patrons when they leave. And, I don't have all the solutions, and I think it's going to be a conversation on Tuesday to find exactly what could be some practices, best practices that can be implemented and instituted here to move forward. I've always said that, if you go out on a night and you're leaving a place, whether you're a man or a woman, you're always better to travel together, not be alone, not walk down the street alone, not leave alone. And that's for everybody. I mean, I think having somebody kind of keeping an eye on each other walking out of these bars, particularly if you've had drinking out all night, kind of keep an eye on each other is what we should be looking at doing.
One last thing on this. I know when you were a legislator, you were not a supporter of the death penalty for a variety of reasons. The feds could seek the death penalty against the guy in this Correa case. Where are you on that?
I mean, that's the whole – I'm not going to get into the whole issue right here. That's the right of the federal government. It's a federal law. If the U.S. Attorney's Office chooses to seek the death penalty, then that's their right.
Are you still opposed to the death penalty in all cases?
I'm personally opposed to the death penalty, but I'm not going to – again, I'm not going to judge what the U.S. Attorney does here because there's plenty of justification for why people should feel that this guy should be put to death if he's found guilty.
Do you want to judge what the judge in the Manafort case did, sentencing him only to 47 months?
Well, he gets I went on my mother's last night, and she was talking about Manafort, saying that he got 47 months in the first case, but he has another case coming that could put some more time. You know, this carried up to a case of 47 years in prison. I honestly thought that he was going to get the stiffer end of the spectrum here. But he does have another case, so this guy's going to be doing probably 10, 12 years in prison.
You know, Mr. Mayor, one more serious thing before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970. Von Abraham wrote a piece yesterday. Is Boston truly looking out for immigrants? Not in this case. She quotes you from a while ago, saying, for as long as I'm mayor, I will never turn my back on those who are seeking a better life. We will continue to foster trusting relationships between law enforcement and the immigrant community. You've discussed it a lot with us. In this case, at least from what I read from Yvonne's piece, the guy has a workers' compensation claim. His boss isn't crazy about it. His boss calls a member of the police force in Boston. The police force member apparently calls ICE, and the guy is snatched. Your statement that's in her piece is you say Boston values and respects immigrants. This is contemporaneous to Yvonne the other day, Abraham. And we will continue standing by our immigrant community who make positive contributions to our city. Safe cities are our first priority, which is why BPD will work with any state or federal authority if criminal activity is in question for any resident in Boston. I heard a BUR story this morning where it appears that is it safe to say you know more than you knew when you made that statement?
Absolutely.
So tell us where you are today.
Let me just be clear. And Boston has in place the Trust Act. And I'm just going to just read it here so we have what the Trust Act is in front of me. A law enforcement official shall not detain an individual on the basis of a civil immigration detainer request or an ICE administrative warrant after the individual is eligible for release from custody unless ICE has a criminal warrant issued by a judicial officer or individual. In saying that, this particular case, it appears that, and I'm still trying to unpack it, but ICE was given a heads up that this person was going to be somewhere, and he was picked up, not on a warrant, not an arrest. He was picked up. I think he had an outstanding warrant from 8 years ago, but I didn't like the way this case came down. And I think that...
Does that mean you're unhappy with how the Boston Police Department handled it?
I'm unhappy about the whole way this particular case got handled.
Including your police department?
Yeah, department? Right now, yeah. In this particular case, which is Boston Police Department and the federal government, I don't like the way this case went down. It doesn't seem to me right now adding up. In the sense of, I guess it adds up under legal terms. There's no question about it. There was fraud committed, and there was an arrest made. But it seems like an employer here was trying to kind of get back an employee. The employer actually made the calls with the assistance, I guess, and it's unclear about what role detectives played in this particular case. But I want to be very clear on when I talk about immigrants in Boston. You know, we shouldn't be criminalizing immigrants. Now, if an immigrant commits a crime and they get arrested for it, If it's a felony, a murder, a rape, serious crime, we will reach out to the federal authorities to let them know that. If it's a warrant for immigration, it's not our job as Boston Police Department or the City of Boston to do the federal government's job in the sense of, unless it's a serious, if we happen to stop somebody and it's a serious crime, we'll do that. This situation that Yvonne Abraham wrote about is still being unpacked as we talk, still trying to get to the bottom of exactly what happened in this particular case. The facts that I have in front of me right now is that this person had a workers' comp claim, used a fake name. I don't know if the company was upset about it, but in my opinion, that does not warrant having the federal government use resources to come in and grab somebody.
One last thing about this, Mr. Mayor, and then we'll get to the calls at 877-301-8970. Both your former commissioner, and I only mention him because Commissioner Gross has only been with us once, so we haven't had an opportunity to talk about it. Commissioner Evans talked about this, how important it was to build trust with the immigrant community so they weren't afraid to use government, to be a witness, to make a complaint.
Absolutely.
You've said it nonstop for the years we've known you. Obviously, this is going to hurt a little bit. How do you rebuild it and assure people that they're not going to get in this kind
of mess? This happened in 2017. So this happened 2 years ago.
Yeah, I understand that.
This just didn't happen.
But people are reading about it yesterday and saying, well, should I not file a workers' comp claim?
It's a little different. It's not that cut and dry. I mean, this is a case where alleged fraud on behalf of the worker who used a fake name and all kinds of other things. But let me just say, be very clear, and I did it with BUR yesterday on the radio, that we are a city, an immigrant city, a friendly immigrant city. I don't want to see people go underground. We have students in our schools that parents are here undocumented. We have people that aren't going for medical care. We want to make sure they go for medical care. We want to make sure that they understand their rights. We want to make sure that they're living here. I mean, in that article, I read it as alluding me to Washington policies, which I took offense to, because I think I'm completely opposite of what Donald Trump stands for when it comes to immigration. And I'm also kind of frustrated at the article, but I'm frustrated at the situation we're in today, is that even with, now we've had a Democratic Congress for a few months, we're still not talking about immigration reform. We have 13 million people in America that are undocumented, and we're talking about a wall. We're falling into the Donald Trump trap of talking about a wall, whether to build a wall, not build a wall. We have 13 million people in this country, and it's not the first time we've had undocumented people in this country, that we have to figure out and come up with immigration policy on how do we create pathways to citizenship and how do we deal with the immigration question in America.
Well, but just to be clear, when you say you're frustrated, based on what you now know, based on what Yvonne knew and having spoken to your people at the time, she reported accurately.
Yeah, I know, but
you've learned more since,
there's a
right?
Comment, there's a comment, I think.
It says the end, that trust has just taken a massive hit.
Yeah, I mean, that's
her last line.
You know, so I think that as we're doing the story, we're working with Yvonne and we're trying to work with people to get more information out. And again, it's you know, I'm not sure when the story started, so it's complicated because things do change and evolve. And then, you know, you hear more and more about, you know, situations and warrants and outstanding warrants. And so there's still probably more to unpack.
So I assume you've spoken to Commissioner Gross about this.
We talked yesterday. We talked the night before.
And?
And, I mean, he reaffirmed what I just read about the Trust Act, and he reaffirmed it to our police department.
Fair enough. We're talking to the mayor of the city of Boston. Now it is your turn, Mr. Mayor. Go right ahead.
Roe in Natick.
Hello, Roe.
For taking my call.
You're welcome. Go.
Mr. Mayor, about 6 weeks or so ago, we were driving on Comm Ave in Boston, and we hit a pothole and ruined a tire on our Jeep.
Oh.
And we put through all the paperwork for a claim to your department and got denied, saying that it was private property. It was clearly Boston Road. It was Comm Ave. We went back the next day and took photos, and lo and behold, the pothole had been filled overnight. So they're saying in my letter that the next step is to file a claim in court. I really think this is overkill, and it's clearly a Boston issue, and I want to know what I can do about this.
Well, I'm not sure when you say that the city came back and said it's private property, and then you say it happened on Comm Ave. I don't know how the city can justify saying it was private property if it was Comm Ave. I guess what I can ask you to do is hold on the radio. I'll get your information, and I'll have somebody from my transportation department call you after the show.
Is that a deal, Ro? Stay on hold. Don't go away.
Thank you very much.
Producers will get your number. That's a pretty good response. 877-301-8970. Mr. Mayor.
Sam in Boston.
Hi, Sam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, you know, having recently been at a memorial for Paula Chiraga, recently a cyclist killed near the Fenway, when is the mayor going to start living up to his promises to build more protected bike infrastructure? When I'm riding out there, very dangerous. I wonder if I'm going to make it home at night. When are you going to live up to the commitment and, you know, pay for it in the budget?
Thanks, Sam. I think if you seem like somebody that pays attention to what's going on, I think you should look at the investments we've made in the city in the last 4 years with dedicated bike lanes. And I think we have some money in the budget this year to add, I think, another 10 miles of dedicated bike lanes to our city. That's not as simple as just putting markers on the road as what happened in the past. We're actually separating bike lanes now. We're creating dedicated bike lanes in the city of Boston. We're creating better connections in the city of Boston. We're working in different neighborhoods of the city. And I think that a lot of our policy is laid out on our City of Boston webpage on the Transportation Department. And I think we have money in this year's budget. So I think we're working towards 10 more miles of dedicated bike lane in the city.
Sam, thank you for the call. You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead,
I'm here, Jim. I just wanted to remind you I'm still here. You talked about, although Jim thinks this is a great idea, I'm not so sure it's a great idea, but in terms of helping what's going on in the streets in Boston, one of the great things, the designated pickup and drop-off sites in certain areas for ride-hailing
services. I love that.
I think that's wonderful. But do you really think, Mr. Mayor, people are going to go 20 miles an hour in the neighborhoods? That's slow.
Not really. Not when you think about, we're talking about side streets now. We're not talking about Boylston Street. We're talking about side streets in our different neighborhoods that if you're going, really you have no right going 25 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour, or even quite honestly 20 miles an hour in some of those posted areas when you're driving down side streets, because there are families and kids and people in the streets. And we're asking people to slow their cars down. We're not talking about Southeast Expressway. We're not talking about Memorial Drive. We're not talking about Boylston Street. We're talking about our side streets in our different neighborhoods that we're looking at reducing the speed limit. Part of it is that, and part of it is yesterday I also spoke about an educational component that we're going to be putting more information out around education, around pedestrians and bicyclists and motor vehicles and understanding the rules of the road. I mean, I know it's people want to get to where they want to get to and they want to get there fast, but there are repercussions when people speed. People get hurt. People get hit by cars. People get killed. And we're asking people to slow down.
You know, I'm sorry, Marjorie.
No, there was one other thing I think is a great idea, the drop-off and pickup sites for rideshares, because they do cause terrible backups when they're all, like, essentially double parking. But tell people what you're doing about the kids with the MBTA passes.
Drop off. What we're doing is we're running a pilot program in the Fenway area for Lyft and Uber. We're going to be setting up designated areas where people can drop people off and pick people up, similar to what you'd see with a cab stand, and try and get congestion off the streets and move people over. So that's one thing we're doing.
Great idea.
And then yesterday we announced that some of the kids in the city of Boston had a pass that gave them a 10-month pass for the MBTA, where they could take the MBTA, basically a free pass for the MBTA. And we negotiated a deal with the MBTA, Steve Poftak, to have 10 months a year passes for our kids in our public parochial charter and private schools in the city of Boston. It's going to cost the city, I forget the exact number, six-something million dollars to do it. But what it does, it'll hopefully reduce congestion off our streets and have put more young people onto public transportation, and also create this idea of using public transit more. I mean, young people don't drive as much. They take Uber and Lyft, which is surprising to me because when I was young, we wanted to drive. But trying to get more people committed to the MBTA is important. And also then working with the MBTA, quite honestly, they're making an $8 billion investment over the next 5 years for their infrastructure. They're proposing a fare increase. And what I've asked for, if they're going to increase the fares, don't increase the fares on kids, don't increase the fares on seniors, and be very, very deliberate about where the investments are going and let people know where this additional revenue is going to go. So people, I don't think, mind paying for something as long as they feel that something is going to be improved by it. And I think explaining to people where the fare increase is going to go and how this will improve the service and the customer experience, I think would be a good thing.
You know, before we leave transportation, and by the way, we should have said as a predicate to this, all these things are in a transportation improvement plan that you announced yesterday.
Yeah, at the Minnesota.
A couple of things. The governor of Ohio, who's Republican, DeWine, very conservative guy, used to lobby him when he was a congressman in Washington, so I know him a little bit, just signed a gas tax increase, a Republican. The Democratic governor of Michigan, Whitmer, who I assume you know, just signed proposed a 45-cent increase in the gas tax, not primarily, for infrastructure repair, same sort of problems we have here. Should we be increasing the gas tax?
I mean, we did. I voted for it. I mean, I was a state rep. I voted for the increase in the gas tax.
That was a while ago, too. We're still way below.
We indexed it, but unfortunately, the voters of Massachusetts overturned the legislative action there. And I think that...
Should it be raised again?
I think we have to have a conversation about raising it again so people understand that we're going to raise this. And I think if you explain to people where this money would go, I think they'd be open to the idea. In 2000, I think it was 16, when this got overturned, Was it 16?
Right, it was 16.
No, it was 14.
14, right, 14. On the ballot, it was.
It was on the ballot, the November of 2014.
The indexing, yeah.
You know, there was a governor's race at the time, and there was a lot of conversation about taxation and raising taxes, and I honestly think if you have a conversation, I'd like to hear from people that call in, who's on the hold now, whatever the issue you want to talk about, just tell us where you feel on raising the gas tax.
Great idea.
I think we need to hear that from people.
One other thing, you know what I do in my spare time when I don't have anything to do? I listen to old broadcasts with you from the radio.
Oh, great stuff. What did I say that I changed my opinion?
But this is, no, I don't think you did. This is May 2017. We're talking about pedestrians and the whole issue, pedestrians, Roger. Here's what you had to say at the time.
Let me just say this. This is where I'm going to get myself in trouble right now on the show.
Thanks, Jim.
There's a lot of talk about what's the city doing to make everything safer. Pedestrians need to be safer. Pedestrians need to put their head up when they're walking down the street, take your headphones off, cross in the crosswalk, follow the lights. You can't be running across the middle of a street. You got to understand cars are going to hit you. If you're in New York City, anyone that goes to New York City, you step off the sidewalk and you're not in a crosswalk, they're taking you out. And I think that what we're doing, I'll explain in a second what we're doing in the city, but people need to be more cognizant of the fact that a car is a car. And even bicyclists, when you're riding, a car can't stop on a dime.
By the way, I didn't play that just to embarrass you.
I was young and foolish back then.
But in all seriousness here, I called Marjorie last night when I got home at about 9 o'clock. And this is true. It takes me 12 minutes to drive from GBH to my house in Cambridge. There were two cyclists who, if I had not been paying 100% attention at that particular moment, I would have killed, who were out of their lane, riding in the wrong direction. The reason I bring this up, it relates to your pedestrian comment, isn't one of the things that needs to be done is incredible enforcement? But I know it's a lot of energy and resources. Whether it's a cyclist, a driver, a pedestrian, if they're violating the law, it makes it unsafe. Enforce the law.
I think it's enforcement, and it's also education. And it has to be both. And yesterday we talked about that. I talked about that in my speech, that we're going to do this citywide educational program because I think it's important for us to kind of understand the rules of the road. And when I say us, anybody who uses the road, and walking, biking, riding, whatever you want to do, it's important for that. And the enforcement piece is important as well. And I think that one of the things that I think cities and towns struggle with is that you can't be everywhere all the time. And when you see a situation like you experienced yesterday, I think if there was an opportunity for a police officer to see that, they can pull the bicyclist over. But again, it's I think there's enforcement that happens, but there's, you know, think about Boston. We have 47 square miles, roughly, 700,000 people in the city of Boston. In the course of the day, we more than double in size with the amount of people coming to work. And we have, you know, our police department's 2,000 people in Boston. So when you think about the priorities and what the importance is, everything's important. And to every single constituency, it's the most important priority, whether it's bicycle safety, whether it's coming out of a club, whether it's making sure traffic is enforced, making sure neighborhoods are safe, making sure the communities are safe. So, you know, I think that we also filed some legislation that would, if you pass a school bus, would be able to hit you with a ticket through a camera. Enforcement. We file that. Block the box. We want to run a pilot program. People that block the box, that causes a lot of frustration and anger with people driving because they gridlock intersections. We want to be able to run a pilot program to do some ticketing through cameras on block the box.
Even if there's not a cop on the side.
Not
the
a
scene,
cop.
Yeah.
We have a camera there. And we want to pilot these just to see how they work. And what we expect it to do is change patterns and behaviors. When we raised the parking meter, the fines for overstaying in parking meters and parking loading docks, we saw a reduction in double parking. We saw a reduction in overpaid meters. So some of these things that we do, you might not feel it across the board, but there are incremental improvements in certain neighborhoods and certain areas of the city.
You know, Mr. Mayor, earlier this week we were talking to Jennifer McKim. She's from the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, and she did a really sad and upsetting piece about housing court in Boston. You have done a lot with affordable housing. I think you just announced a new plan, $26 million in new housing for people that are either lower middle income or really low income, and that's absolutely fantastic. I think it's 459 units. But I was thinking as I talked to her, what she focused on is people that she had a particular guy that was a Boston bus driver that was forced out of the apartment he'd been in for, I think it was 27 years. And people that were, they don't have lawyers in housing court for the most part if they can't afford them. And they're getting evicted because development is really, you know, blockbusters here in Boston. And I know we've talked about rent control before, which no one seems to like, but isn't there something that can be done to help
people stay? Let me just say, you know, you talk about development in Boston. It's not just Boston. It's in greater Boston. It's in Massachusetts. I mean, we have development that's happening. We have people moving to our city and our region in numbers that we haven't seen in decades and maybe generations. I think that we have started to deal with what we thought was a good housing plan to create housing, 53,000 units of new housing by the year 2030. 2 years and 3 years into that plan, we actually changed that number to 69,000 units of new housing. We're building more housing. And so there is no question that we have a housing crisis in Boston, in the greater Boston area. And when we talk about housing crisis, we're talking about low-income housing and moderate-income housing.
Yep.
Families in the middle class that just can't afford to buy a home. And they're paying rents that should be a mortgage, and it's pushing them out. And what we're trying to do in the city is continue to put the supply on the market to try and keep up with the demand on the market. We're working now a lot more closer with regional mayors in the regional Boston area, where we came up with a housing plan to create 185,000 new units of housing by the year 2030 regionally, not just in Boston. And Boston can't be the only city that's building all the affordable housing for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We need help from cities and towns across the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to increase their affordable housing piece. And then also, we don't have a federal government partner. And people, you know, no one's really paid attention to that piece. We haven't had a federal partner in housing since the last days of the Obama administration, where they were able to get us money to go into federal housing programs. So there's so much demand in so many different areas, which means money's needed, that we really truly have to come up with a comprehensive housing plan. And this issue of housing that we really talk a lot about in Boston and need to talk more about is not just about Boston. It's about New York. It's about San Francisco. It's about Austin. It's about Seattle. It's about all these cities in America that they're faced with the same exact issues. They're facing with a divestment from the federal government into our housing plan, our federal housing authorities. And then we're talking about how do we continue to move forward. So rent control, everyone thinks rent control is the answer. I don't think rent control is the answer. I think the answer to doing this is continue to push the supply on the market, supply of all levels of housing. And we have to start thinking a little more about how do we focus on the families that want to stay in the city, that want to buy a home in the city, and how do we create more opportunities and more programs so people can access, first of all, the understanding to do it, and the second, the capital to do it. And I think there's a whole level of situations here in housing that we have to address.
Two quick questions before we take a break on that subject matter. How do you feel about having just cause evictions so that landlords on a whim can't throw somebody out?
We filed it last year.
You support that?
Yeah, we filed it last year in the legislature.
Are you also a supporter? This is in Jen McKim's piece, too. San Francisco and New York, I think, have passed laws or whatever they call them in those jurisdictions mandating that a low-income person who can't afford a lawyer
has
a housing crisis. So you support that as well?
We support it. We filed the bill.
Have you spoken to the governor about that?
Yeah, we've spoken to the legislature about it.
And they've done nothing?
No, we just filed a whole package. A whole displacement package this year in January, and we're going to focus our efforts. We filed hundreds of bills, and this year we've narrowed our focus on what we want to do. Our focus really has been narrowed to education funding, making sure that it's equitable across the Commonwealth for every city and town, because the benefit not getting an increase in education funding will hurt us in other parts of the budget, and we're focused on housing. We're focused on legal representation, so when somebody goes into housing court, that they're appointed a court-appointed attorney to help them with their cases, because a lot of times people come in, buy buildings, they're dumping people out, they go to housing court, somebody who doesn't have the means to have a lawyer goes into a court, quite honestly, it's intimidating, they don't have any understanding of how the system works, they're intimidated by it, and they just basically don't have the representation. And having somebody be in court with somebody that's being evicted out of their home is something that we're going to work on. We also filed a bill that tenants would have the opportunity potentially for first right of refusal on a home. So if somebody comes in, somebody's going to sell their home and they want to sell a six unit or above, the tenant could come in or tenants could come together and work with a nonprofit to be able to buy that home first right of refusal.
Okay, before we take a break, can you quickly list all the presidential candidates who've called you on the phone?
I've spoken to Senator Warren, clearly, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris. I met her the other day. She's in the office.
In your office?
Yep. It was
okay.
Great.
Who else?
Sherrod Brown, but he decided he's not running today. So those are the four I think I've spoken to so far. Yeah.
Are you inching close to making a decision? Or no,
I'm just what I feel bad about is that the national media is so fixated on Donald Trump that I get concerned that the Democratic candidates who are running for president are getting no airtime. And it seems that when you announce your candidacy, you get a lot of airtime and you cover it for about a week, and then it kind of goes away. Think about it for a minute. You know, this would be a time where CNN and other places would be covering all kinds of news, including presidential candidates, and none of them really have been able to get their message out on. I mean, they do cover town halls, but it's so Donald Trump.
And you know what the solution is? When they call you, when you're done, say, call us.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to. I honestly think that these presidential candidates that are running for president are going to have to go through the local media outlets to get the message out there. And to be quite honest with you, if you can't get it on the big splash on the big TV shows across the country, you got to come to stations like this. You know, you come to GBH once or twice as a candidate, you're going to mention it forever, that they were on the radio with you and they talked about stuff. So I think that, you know, candidates are going to have to start using local media outlets a little more.
We got to take a break.
That's right. Well, tell them about the Newsfeed Cafe, the great Jim and Marjorie sandwich.
And the Mighty Wall sandwich.
Oh, the Mighty Wall sandwich.
That's right. Was it yours? Chicken Parm?
Chicken
is that what
Palm,
it is?
Chicken Parm, yep.
Yes, excellent. Mayor Marty Walsh is taking our questions and your calls. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. I am live from the Boston Public Library, or GBH studio, as is the mayor. Marjorie is in Brighton, which someday she'll explain. If you're just tuning in, Mayor Marty Walsh is here for his monthly visit, taking your questions and ours. Call him at 877. Well, the lines are full. 877-301-8970. Email him at bprwgbh.org or tweet him at BOS Public Radio. Marjorie.
Mr. Mayor, a couple of questions about the schools. This preceded your time as mayor because apparently for more than a decade, this is according to a story by James Vasness in the Boston Globe, the city has resisted requiring these set of courses that the state wants to kids to get called Mass Corps that supposedly helps them. Well, it doesn't supposedly. It does help them with college success. I guess less than one-third of the kids in Boston are getting these Mass Corps, this more strict curriculum, while most kids in other towns are. And we talked to Paul Revel yesterday, who used to be the Secretary of Education, and his thesis is that the reason that it was resisted in so many Boston schools is because it was going to hurt graduation rates. Your interim superintendent, Laura Perel, is taking care of this. We're going to try to take care of this. But it was just kind of stunning, considering the story the Globe just had about the valedictorians from so many of the Boston high schools unable to finish college, basically because many of them were not prepared. They had other issues, but a lot of it had to do with preparation. So I guess you wonder, how does this go on for a decade and nobody knows about it?
I mean, I think there's a lot of issues that have been, I don't want to say ignored in the Boston Public Schools, but haven't been dealt with in decades. And I think that there's a lot, you know, being the mayor now for 5 years, I'm in my sixth year, still trying to unpack some of the bureaucracy at the school department, try and make sure that we get the proper, you know, instruction down to the classroom. It's complicated, and you know, I was at the Municipal Resource Bureau speech yesterday. I talked about this, and I talked about some of the gains that we've made in the city in the last 5 years, but I've also said that I'm not happy about that we haven't made enough gains in the last 5 years. When you read the valedictorian story, that's one aspect of our school department that you know, it's frustrating, and I don't think that whole story should be based on Boston education for our kids. I think part of it is on the young people that leave and go into higher education to be successful and to push themselves to be successful. But I think there's a lot that we still have to continue to unpack in our school district that has been ignored, quite honestly, for decades.
Do you support that implementation of that Mass Corps level of testing?
I honestly don't know enough about it. And I'm not to deflect the question. We'll talk about it next
month. Next month, fine.
But I don't know enough about it to say, because I mean, there's a lot. There's conversations around do we teach in some places? Are we teaching too much towards the MCAS? Are we testing our kids too much? Are we not teaching civics? Are we not doing this? Not doing that? It's easy to kind of Monday morning quarterback, but I think it's time that we have to stop the, at least when I say we, me, the city, school department, the school committee. we just need to start implementing and moving forward.
You know, one last thing on education. There was an article in the Globe the other day about how slowly the superintendent, the new superintendent selection process, gone. Andrea Campbell, the head of the city council, wrote a piece in which she said, talked about the threat of elected leaders micromanaging. I assume she was talking about you. She didn't name you. But Paul Revel also said yesterday the rumors in the education community that one of the reasons it's moving so slowly is because you want to give Laura Perrill, the interim superintendent, who's not a candidate, more time to do the kinds of tough things that somebody who doesn't have to worry about a future tenure is going to do. Is that true?
No. First of all, I don't know what most slowly means. We are probably, I was saying this yesterday, I was talking to a reporter yesterday, 2 days ago in my office, that we're probably about a month behind where we were under the Tommy Chang search. We were interviewing the final four candidates in April, the last time we had the superintendent search. We were able to get somebody in place by the following September. I feel that we are on course to have a new superintendent by the beginning of the school year coming up. The committee, I think, you know, in the President Campbell's op-ed, you know, it was kind of unclear what she was asking for there. She talked about transparency, but I don't know what that means in transparency. We have a process that's moving forward right now that people have submitted their names. We have, from what I understand, I haven't talked to the selection committee. I haven't seen the names yet. We have some really good potential candidates in this pool of candidates, so people who have been superintendents around the country and some folks that are from Massachusetts. So we have a good diverse group of talented people that are in the pool. So
when do we hear the finalist names?
I'm not sure exactly when the finals come. I think they're talking like May, June-ish.
Okay. Let's go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
Irene in Burlington.
Hello, Irene. Irene.
Hi.
Irene. Sorry, Irene.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First-time caller.
Thanks.
I have two quick questions for you, Mayor. The first question is, why can't we have garbage pickup like at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning? They do that in New York City. I can't tell you how many times I've been behind a garbage truck, not just in Boston, but Cambridge and Somerville, and I've been very late because there's no place to go.
What's your second question? Give us both, so the mayor.
The first question, do you mean in the neighborhoods, too?
Yeah, in the neighborhoods, yeah. I picked up my niece who goes to school in New York at 2 a.m., and I was behind a garbage truck. And I thought, gee, that's so brilliant. No kidding. I mean, it just makes so much sense because there's no traffic.
What's your other question? Then I'll answer both.
Speaking of New York, if you go down a street and you go 25 miles an hour, you can drive through about 10, 15 lights for almost a mile. Why can't you do that in Boston? I mean, I'm driving down Beacon Street. I see the green light, the next one. I got a red light. The light turns green. And don't you know it, if I don't gun it, I'm going to hit every light.
We got it.
Why can't we coordinate
lights? We got
lights?
It. How about it, Mr. Mayor? Thank you, Irene.
First one is there's no way that people in the city of Boston will want trash pick up before 7 a.m. They're sleeping. I have about 700 heads nodding here in front of me right now that if I propose that I was going to do a 2 o'clock in the morning trash pickup, I think I'd get charged here. So I think that there are certain areas in the city that we can certainly do early morning pickup in certain business districts. We're a whole different city than New York City. And trying to compare Boston and New York, it's very two different entities. New York does a lot of it because they're buildings and there's a lot of trash and there's blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks of skyscrapers and in those areas. That's why they do it in New York. On the timing of the lights, I think that part of the rationale many years ago was that to have the go from a green light to a red light to a green light to a red light was to slow traffic down in the city. We're working right now on with the state on something that's called adaptive traffic signals, and we want to upgrade our traffic signals so that certain times of the day we can move traffic along the city of Boston, and there are certain times of the day that we can slow traffic down if we need to. And we're working towards that system. We're dealing, it's technology, and when I came in as mayor in 2014, I committed to doing a lot of updates in technology, and that one of the updates in technology has to be traffic signalization, and we're working towards a plan on that. It's going to cost a lot of money, but that's part of the reason for it. We do adjust lights.
Sorry.
Just so people know, we do adjust lights. There are times where we will get a call. It happened around Franklin Park the other day that the light was turning red every 10 seconds and or more like 20 seconds and not enough cars are going through. We heard about it. We went out and made adjustments on the light signalization. But we have to definitely, we're headed towards a society where we're going to have a lot better technology around our traffic lights and enforcement.
Irene, thanks. Hey, Mr. Mayor, Marjorie and I talked to our listeners at the top of the show. Ayanna Pressley filed an amendment to lower the federal voting age of 16. It was defeated. Andy Vargas, who I just met last night, a state rep from Haverhill, young guy, 25 years old, filed a bill not to have 16-year-olds vote statewide, but to allow any city or town to vote through its appropriate process to lower the voting age of 17 or 16 without further state approval, meaning they'd get advance approval. If you want to raise it in Boston.
I think we can do that now.
No, you can't.
Oh, I thought we could.
But would you support that?
I don't know if I'd support 16. I think that.
Would you support being given the cities and towns being given the right to make the decision themselves?
Yeah, if I was in the legislature and somebody said any ability to give the cities and towns their more autonomy to do whatever they want, like raise revenue, maybe
you're
lower
for
the,
it.
I'm absolutely for it.
So if you had that autonomy, where would you be on lowering the voting age in Boston?
I don't. I've had some conversations with our we have a youth council in the city. And they've met with me several times and advocated for it. I haven't really taken a position on it.
What's your gut?
I think 16 is too young.
How about 17?
I think 17 is worth having a conversation about.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, in Mr. Mayor, this study from something called Predict Wise in the Atlantic said that all Massachusetts counties are among the most prejudiced toward political other, and Suffolk County is the worst of all.
Yeah, can you explain that to me? I read the can you explain what that article meant?
Well, you know, I think we're heavily Democratic, but there's lot of independence. So I don't know. I mean, you've lived in Dorchester all your life, or the city most of your life.
All my life.
You think this is true? Are we a bunch of
we the most intolerant people in the country?
No.
Okay, well, fine. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Let's go back to the calls. That takes care of that.
All right, Susan in Jamaica Plain, help me out here.
Hi, Susan. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a question. This has to do with housing again.
Yeah.
And, it's fine.
For veterans, I'm a veteran, and I grew up in the city of Boston. I work in the city of Boston. And right now I have a voucher, but I can't seem to get a place in Boston. Are there any more places being opened up?
Yeah,
or?
Stay on the line, Susan. Let me get your information. I'll have somebody reach out to you today. One of the things that I'm not saying you're homeless, but one of the things that we tackled was homelessness for veterans, and we got some great response from homeowners who wanted to open their apartments, their empty apartments to veterans, veterans that had vouchers. And let me get your information, and let me have somebody from the Department of Neighborhood Development call you. And we'll try and help you with that.
Susan, do not go away. Stay on hold, and our producers will get your contact information. And as you heard, the mayor's office will be in touch with you. Thank you very much for your call, and lots of luck.
Hey, Mr. Mayor, the Herald reported that you might run for governor.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
No, you said it.
I didn't say I was running for governor.
Well, you said you might run. She didn't say that. She said you might run for governor.
I'm focused on being mayor right now, and, you know, it's a long way away.
Okay.
But
okay.
You didn't say you wouldn't. You didn't rule it out. You said you might
say anything.
Apparently so.
Okay,
and we'll play
check.
It back to you in 2 years, too.
Yeah, will you please?
Susan, thanks for the call. Let's go to the next one, Mr.
John
Mayor.
John on the road.
Hi, John.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Sir, I wanted to actually comment on this on how is Boston looks. It's beautiful. It's changed a lot since my family moved here since 1999, and it's beautiful right now. There was something that was been bugging me for a while. There's many people like me, you know, immigrants, and back home, we probably don't have the same standards of living as we do up here in the U.S. But I was wondering, is there any plans to start any campaign or anything like that so people don't litter on the streets? Because there's a lot of trash on the streets in East Boston. And even
sorry, John, go ahead.
Money cleaning the streets, they still, you know, A lot of people, you know, throwing trash in the streets.
Yeah.
Can we start a campaign in, you know, different languages, Spanish, English, and whatever other languages, mostly in East Boston?
Yeah, let me just say this. I think that we do a lot around working towards having a clean street. I think clean streets, I think we have a very clean city, and I don't like litter. I don't think it's the city's responsibility alone to clean the streets of Boston. I think it's up to homeowners and renters and businesses and people to go in front of their property and clean up. And I think the campaign needs to start from the grassroots around communities about beautification and appreciating your neighborhoods. We have a program called Love Your Block that organizations can apply for. It's something we started, I think, in 2015 that different organizations have applied for and trying to do some improvements around the neighborhood. I think the best way to start it is I'm the mayor of Boston, and I'm asking people who live in Boston listening to this radio station to go out and clean in front of your house. If your business is in our city, clean in front of your business. If there's a barrel overflowing on the street that's a city barrel, you can call the city, we'll pick it up. Or you can actually, it won't harm anybody by emptying the barrel and putting in your trash. I think there's ways for us to kind of all step up. This can't be from the top down. This has to be from the bottom up, meaning pride by everybody. And I think it's really important that we take pride in the city of Boston that we live in. And I think that, our public works department, once the snow melts, we'll be out there with our street sweepers. We've never done that before. In the last 5 years, we started that by having street sweepers out in the street trying to get the trash under the snow. But I think having everyone step up together and appreciate your street. And then don't be throwing litter out the window in the car. And don't be throwing cigarette butts on the street. And respect the streets as if it's your living room. And I think that's something that we'd like to ask people to do.
John, thank you.
But thank you, John.
Thank you very much for the call there. Want to take another one there?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Marjorie. You're about to say
Marjorie.
Something.
No, I was just going to say that bicyclists is a very passionate issue in Boston. Mr. Mayor, getting a lot of emails about bicycling. But I get kind of one sort of funny from Michael, who says that apparently one of his best friends was on a jury. I don't know why the judge was asking about bicyclists, but apparently during voir dire, when they picked the jurors, he asked who here feels and really annoyed when they see a bike rider. And apparently everybody in the jury pool raised their hands. So there seems to be huge hostility between drivers and bicycle riders, because we have other bicyclists have been riding in saying that, drivers, who says that cars should have the right of the road and so forth
yeah.
and so on.
It's interesting.
Very passionate issue.
It is a passionate issue, and a stat that I talked about yesterday, which I was very surprised with, the blue bikes that are on the street.
Yes.
We had 1.7 million trips on those last year.
Wow.
So how many?
1.7 million trips. Yes.
So that's considered a lot, right?
I think that's a lot. That's on top of the private, so-called private cyclists that cycle into work. And even in the city, when I go to work today, I'll pull in, there's a bike rack next to where I park, and there'll be, it's a winter time, so there'll probably be 8 or 10 bikes there. But in the summertime, there's no surprise that could have 20, 25 bikes at the bike station right outside my office. And a lot more and more people are using bicycles as transportation, motor transportation. And I think that rather than, criticize people that are bicyclists, we should be applauding them, and we should be working with them to make sure that everyone feels comfortable. The guy that he called earlier, Sam, and Sam, was seemed a little frustrated with the city of where we are on bikes. When we started doing bike lanes years ago, it was a painted line down the middle of the street. And everyone thought that was innovative and genius, and it was at the time. And now, as time evolved, people want to make sure there's separated bike lanes so people who are on bikes can stay in their lane, but they have a lane to stay in. And to Jim's point earlier, when he was driving and got people, cyclists going in front of him, if there was a dedicated bike lane, then those bike lanes would be in their lane, and Jim would be in his lane, and we'd have our different lanes. And I think in the city, over the next 5 to 10 years, we will see a lot more of these lanes happening. When I talked about earlier, I mentioned 47 miles. We're a 47 square mile city. We have 800 miles of road in the city of Boston. So when you think about creating dedicated opportunity bike lanes, that's going to be billions of dollars over probably the next decade to be able to have true dedicated bike lanes throughout the entire city of Boston. And that's something that we're thriving for and moving towards. And that doesn't take away from people driving cars. What it does, it separates the two so that you're in a separated bike lane. We're having a Calm Ave now. It'll cut down on fatalities, and it also will allow people to have better modes of transportation, which I think is really important in the city.
One last thing before you go, Mr. Mayor, and we're almost out of time. There's a generational – you're a big-time Democrat and an ardent Democrat. There's clearly a generational divide in the Democratic Party in Washington. I mentioned Ayanna Pressley and her 16-year-old should be able to vote thing. On the impeachment issue, which I think is dividing the Democratic Party, a lot of the young and new congresspeople think the move should happen now, that the evidence is there. We don't need to wait. The American people don't need to wait for Mueller's report. Pressley told me in the debate I did with her and then the incumbent Capuano that she thought the case for impeachment had been made. Then Nancy Pelosi has gone out of her way to say, no, 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 now is not the time. Wait for Mueller. What is the right balance for the Democratic Party? I mean, you're a big critic of the president,
I think you have to wait for the report to come out. I mean, the report has details.
Mueller's
report. The report will have details that the American people don't know. I honestly think that a lot of us have our feelings about the president, and I've been no stranger to let my feelings known about the president.
Do you think he's committed? We know that he's committed impeachable offenses already.
Do I think? Again, I want to see the report. I don't want to jump to a conclusion without seeing all the facts in front of me. I mean, I could say as a Democrat, of course, let's impeach him because we don't want him there anymore. But you have to wait till the facts are there. You can't just take action without seeing the facts. And I think the Mueller investigation has been very interesting because now you have several people who have been sentenced to prison. That have come out of this report that were all around Donald Trump, and you hear Cohen the other day talking, you know, ill of Donald Trump. Manafort is changing his tune on Donald Trump. The guy Stone there, I don't know what he's going to do. I think it was Flynn, another guy who kind of talked about Donald Trump. I think you have to wait till all the facts are in front of us.
Fair enough, Mr. Mayor. It's good to see you.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Mayor. Sorry I missed you today.
Marjorie, you were missed here today.
I did. I know. I missed you too. But you'll be back next month, and
I'll be back next month.
I'll be back next month too.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mayor Walsh joins us
every month for Ask the Mayor, taking our questions and yours. Thank you again, Mr. Mayor. Up next, Joe Biden's past is under scrutiny, and his tough talk on school desegregation could cause problems for 2020. Callie Crossey joins for that and much more next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bradley. I am live from our GVH studio at the Boston Public Library, and Marjorie is live from our Brighton studio for reasons that are undisclosed. Joining us, as she does every Friday, at the Boston Public Library, where she's supposed to be, is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, who would obviously be Callie Crossley. Hi, Callie. How are you?
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello,
how weird
Callie
is
Crossley.
It? You look to the left. Who's
I know,
not
it's
there?
Very bizarre.
What
I know.
Is going on?
I'm like
there?
A disembodied voice.
You
yes,
are.
But
yes.
I'm here. I'm here back in the studio.
Okay.
So people have been talking all week long about this incredible documentary, Neverland.
Oh, yeah. Leaving Neverland.
About Michael Jackson, mm-hmm. and with two men talking about how they were sexually abused by him as children. Now we have this piece in Forbes from a guy, Joe Vogel, who wrote a biography of Michael Jackson. And he's claiming that Mr. Robeson had financial problems, and that's why he decided
change his story.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you think?
I don't know. He makes a kind of credible case, particularly since he had to change his GoFundMe page or whatever page he had on his website. On the other hand, have you seen the die? Have you either of you seen it?
I've seen the whole thing.
Yeah.
I thought they were very compelling.
It's very compelling, and you think to yourself, who would want to tell this story? And the way that the filmmaker lays out the story so carefully, I mean, he doesn't. It's not tabloidy at all. He doesn't sort of hit you in the face with it. He builds it up so that you understand how this could happen. And I think in that way, you realize how it happens outside of celebrity settings, actually, to me. That it definitely would happen with a celebrity. But even without a celebrity, you can sort of see how it happens. So anyway, I just think I think it's good that this guy from Forbes makes us, think carefully about, because these are very serious charges. And you got to figure out must be some monies, you think, anyway, somewhere in this whole scenario. And he makes a case that perhaps it could be at least for one of them. But I don't know. You could still have pursued money early on, still have come to grips with the fact that you were molested, still have determined, because that you didn't get any money, well, you know what? It's still important for me to tell my story. So I'm sort of betwixt in between. I don't know where you are.
Well, I have to say I'm not betwixt in between because, one of the things that really, not only, and the place we totally agree is the thing was incredibly powerful, but what really did it for me, not only watching the 4 hours, I haven't watched the Oprah interviews afterwards, which people say are really impressive. I had two people who were as central to the Catholic Church sexual abuse thing in this diocese. Is that Phil Salviano, one of the founders of SNAP, and Mitchell Garabedian, who is a lawyer who should as far as I'm concerned, win every award and prize you can give him, represented thousands of survivors. And they talked about so many of the behaviors, including continuing to support Michael Jackson, going to court in the first civil trial to defend him, which was a lie, according to them, that he hadn't done anything, is the kinds of behaviors, superstar, priest, uncle, that happens all the time. So, on its face, Vogel does make in Forbes some relatively compelling arguments, but I think at the end of the day, the behaviors, denial, late coming to the fair, even though there's not repressed memory issues here, they both said that.
Yeah.
They knew it all along. I found these guys to be totally and completely compelling, and it makes me sad, not just for them, but because, like Renee Graham in her great column the other day in the Boston Globe, Jackson was, you know, one of my favorite artists ever. Was.
Yeah, I mean, if you're watching the documentary, it is really hard. I mean, you're just, you know, having a disconnect the whole time. You're watching that and then knowing, you know, what you felt like as a fan and then putting the times together. Because if people haven't seen the documentary, he's very carefully let you know what year you're in. Mm-hmm. So you have a sense of it's a lot. But my point is, I guess I'm saying is that I wouldn't say it's not that what Robson or whichever one was doing it reached out to try to get some money from the estate, but at the same time could also come forward. That's guess what I'm saying is that you could have a both-and situation in here. And traditionally, that should make you question what his motives were. But my thing is, hey, he tried to get some money, didn't get it, and that does not necessarily, in this case, diminish what he may have to say about what happened to him. That gives us what I'm saying.
We're talking to Kelly Crossley from Under the Radar. You know, Kelly, it appears that Joe Biden, if reports are to be believed, is days away from announcing his presidential candidacy. And there clearly are some problems from the past. Marjorie and I think you, but I know we have discussed the whole. He has apologized for this, but I don't know if it's been accepted by Anita Hill. His conduct as the chair of the Judiciary Committee of the Clarence Thomas hearings, where he barred certain witnesses who would have corroborated the testimony of Anita Hill and probably, maybe, led to a different outcome with Clarence Thomas. But there's a new story. Matt Visor, actually, the brilliant former Globe reporter, now at the Washington Post. Biden's tough talk on 1970 school desegregation plan could get new scrutiny in today's Democratic Party. He said in the 70s, when he was a young senator, freshman senator, 40-some years ago, government should have a limited role in integration, he said, when there was a busing proposal. I don't buy the concept, he said, popular in the 60s. We have suppressed the black man for 300 years, and the white man is now far ahead in the race for everything our society offers. In order to even the score, we must now give the black man a head start or even hold the white man back to even the race. I don't buy that. He goes on and on saying things that I don't think he'd be saying in 2019. It was almost five decades ago. But at a pretty critical moment in American history. What's your reaction to this?
My reaction is that he's going to probably have to answer for this. I mean, we had this discussion about a week ago with regard to Kamala Harris.
On her attorney generalship,
right. And since then, I believe she's come out and made some comment about some of those cases that she was involved in that are problematic for people who might otherwise be interested in supporting her, or maybe even not, but they have some issues with it. So I think that this is something he's going to have to address head on. So far, by the way, they did, Matt Visor did try to reach out to him. He said he wasn't making any comment on it, but I don't think this, when you read this entire article, the comments are very strong. So I think he has to say something about it. And I think it has to be more than, you know, that was then and this is now. I think they're, you know, give me some sense of, you know, how can this be the same person and what do you understand now differently? If you do, if you don't, you know, why do you still say? Because it somewhere in this piece it said, at the time, he said he didn't, you know, believe that he was going. He didn't think that busing was a good way of achieving. And he made a point of making a distinction between integration and desegregation, which I would do myself. But he didn't support that as a method of equity, bringing about some equity.
And but I think the deeper problem is not just that, at least from my perspective. Is his stated position at the time that there was a limited government role in this. Without government intervention, we might be back where we were decades ago.
I think there's both things he has to address. I actually do think that. And to me, the thing that got me was the fundamental misunderstanding, at least as his quotes indicate here, that it's not about some black parents trying to have their kids sit next to the white kid. That's not the point. The resources are over there. Mm-hmm. That's the point. And if they're taxpaying people, and they are, they should be able to make use of the same resources that every other child has. So if I can't get it this way because of the way that you have construed either de facto or de jure segregation, and one way I can get it is to make sure my kid is in the same school, because you're not going to deny mm-hmm. your kid those resources. That's the point. So I'm interested in his, you know, responding to wherever he was at that point. But I think here's the point that you and I are making. Whoever they are and will come to be running, people have to go back and deal with what's been said. And you know, and it's more than just sort of dismissing it. It really is trying to bring us, those who are considering them certainly for office, as to where you were in your thinking and either your evolution or not. If you haven't evolved, you know, stand up and say it.
I was just going to say candor, authenticity you know, sells, even if you're not crazy about the message.
Yeah.
I can agree with you.
By the way, I'm curious, if he says he was ignorant back then, he didn't think things through, he has evolved, how much does that matter?
No, I think what I'm trying to say is I think it has to be more than that. I think that he has to take us on a journey of the evolution. I think with some of these large issues, and this is very the reason that Matt is writing. Well, he's writing an article for obvious reasons, but he also goes into fine detail about, you know, what does this say for a lot of the African Americans who have, you know, fairly pretty much solidly supported him. So that's why I'm saying it's not a casual.
Yeah.
I knew better. I know better now. Uh-uh.
Okay.
Well, let's have some conversation about this. Let's have some take us on the evolution, if there has been one or not, you know, as I'm saying.
And before we get to your Jim's weekly question about Michelle Obama.
It's not my question.
Yeah, in her future. the story that talks about the story you have in front of us today mm-hmm. talks about how she cried for half an hour during her last flight on Air Force One.
Yeah, I know. That was something, wasn't it?
Yeah, she's very willing to share her emotions and her sadnesses and her lonelinesses. That's why, I mean, we've had this conversation a million times. That's why I liked your book so much. Okay, is Michelle Obama going to run for president like Jim thinks that she has to and should to rescue the Democratic Party?
As somebody screamed from the room where she was speaking, talking about crying, and she answered by shaking her head and replying, nope, nope, nope. I don't know how many more times she could say, no, 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 not me. But more than that, she went on to say, you know, I've quoted her from her speech here at Simmons before she went on book tour, when she said, why aren't we supporting those people who have been in the trenches, who are doing this work, who are you know, working for government now, and we should support them. They're skilled at that. They have those skills. I don't. In this piece, what she's saying is, even if you don't believe that, I said that, understand that Barack and I needed to move out of the way to allow a new generation of people to step up. And they're never going to be able to step up if we're sitting in the way.
Okay, so here's a quiz for the two of you. This is my weekly quiz.
Okay, Jim.
Okay, take your time. Yep. You have to raise your hand to answer. Which young United States senator, when asked by the legendary late Tim Russert, will you be running for president in the next election cycle, said,
one.
Not a chance. Who would that be, please?
Well, that would be Barack Obama, but
ding,
that
ding,
was different.
Ding, 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 ding. That is exactly
different.
Correct.
I would say that's different.
How's that different?
First of all, women know their minds better than men.
Okay, yes.
If I could say that. so I just think that was different. I think that he was in a space where he believed that politics could be a tool by which he could do what he really wanted to do, which was change communities. I mean, the basis of his whole thing is community organizing. Let's make the world better. Let's make my community better. And he had already come to that understanding because he was in the government at that point, realizing that this was a tool to do it. And later, when he was persuaded that, hey, I could do it even better if I had a bigger platform, she has never been interested, period, ever. Never.
Well, let me just say, to tell you the kind of person I am, which I'm quite proud of, when Michelle Obama announces her candidacy, I will only say to both of you, I called you so once.
You will.
Is that a deal?
Uh-huh.
Just
uh-huh.
once. We're talking to Callie Crossley from Under the Radar.
And first of all, we know that's not true. So let's.
That's
just
probably not true. By the way, Amanda, our coworker, just typed in capital letters, which she never does, on our screen. Her memoir is amazing.
It is amazing.
Yes, it
which is
amazing.
Exactly what you
like
both said.
Like I said, I was really surprised because lots of times these political, the memoirs of political people. You know what I'm saying? They're not really, they're not real.
Well, and she's not political. That's
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And she talked and over again about how much she couldn't stand politics. But the authenticity was what really attracted me. Anyway, this is a really heartbreaking story about this a black counselor, the lone black counselor at Boy Scout camp. Tell us what happened to this guy. This is Chris Vogel, but a different Chris Vogel. I mean, it's different Vogel.
So this, he's an Eagle Scout. This guy's name is Boy Scout Counselor Chris Vogel. And there is a camp that the Boy Scouts have called Camp Squanto in Plymouth. And apparently a tradition has been at the end of each of these summer camps that they make up supposedly fun awards. You know, not true awards, but fun awards. And in this particular one, which was happened last year, they gave him the only black staffer the Evil Monkey Award. Now, he's, aside from the fact that he generally very well liked and, you know, not evil at all, so it wasn't even appropriate, nobody could figure out why is this supposed to be funny. I should note that another staffer, the camp disciplinarian, according to this article, was given the Nantucket Nazi Award.
Yeah. That's really funny, too.
I just don't see the humor in either of these. But anyway, Vogel said, some of the leadership, some of the Boy Scout leadership was sitting there. They said nothing. He then went on to file a complaint with the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, and it's supposed to have a hearing later this month. So I have many things to say. First of all, this is outrageous, and the fact that Boy Scout leadership is sitting there is the reason why they are, in my mind, making a power grab to have Girl Scouts join them for no other reason than to shore up their pathetic organization. So let me be on board for that. I was just with some real Girl Scouts, some true leaders, earlier this week, and this kind of nonsense would not be happening, and it makes me sick to know that there are now some girls who might be in situations like this. This is all boys, but it's still the same thing. And back in my day, being a Boy Scout really meant something. Those guys were great and strong and wonderful. And to see that the reputation of the organization and what this guy, this counselor, this Chris Vogel, was trying to instill in the boys that he was working with, just be thrown out because they clearly are not getting any of the messages about what community, what leadership, what support means. If you think this is funny at the end of the camp, this is at the beginning of the camp where perhaps we could have lessons about it, the rest of it. This is the end. What did you learn? What did you take away? Are you kidding me? I hope he wins. I hope he, and by the way, he's asked for $100,000, which he says he hopes will send a message to the broader organization. Well, you can't send it strong enough after this kind of nonsense. This is crazy.
Well, by the way, Michael Levinson wrote the piece in the Globe, makes out what I think is an important point here, is ordinarily the defense, if that's probably a porch, the explanation of something like this is it was a stupid off-the-cuff remark. Levinson makes the point that this Nantucket Nazi evil monkey thing was handwritten down. So it was time to give it thought.
Yes.
Someone thought through it, decided they were going to do it, wrote it down, and then made these, quote,
and
award
didn't see
announcements.
Apparently why this is wrong.
Yeah.
And what did you do to those young boys who were sitting there? You know, at the end of the camp, I'd like to point out. Girl Scouts, there is an organization for you. Do not go to the phony one.
Were you a Girl Scout?
Absolutely.
In Memphis, you were a Girl Scout?
I certainly was, and a Brownie.
Oh, my God. So was I.
Thank you very much.
You were, too? I didn't know that.
Yeah, do you know how many women in Congress were Girl Scouts? That's what true leadership is.
I'm going to find out now. How many?
I'm trying to tell you. We're leaders, baby.
So, Callie, what are you doing? What are you doing Sunday night on Under the Radar?
I'm talking with my regional contributors, and we're looking at a program. Hopefully, we won't have any more snow, but if we do, the mayor of Providence has a city-sponsored plan to help feed those kids who are out of school if they have a snow day, because normally they might get free lunch. And there is a significant amount of kids who would normally get free lunch, so that we think it's a great thing. A lot of dogs on the Cape are stoned. Because
stoned,
S-T-O-N-E-D.
Like marijuana stoned?
That is correct. They are every day, the veterinarians are getting. I know it sounds funny, but
actually
it's not.
I know someone else who is too, but go ahead.
Because of the recreational marijuana, and people are, I guess, leaving it out or whatever, the dogs are getting into it. So hundreds of dogs are ending up at the vets. This is bad for them, I needn't remind you. And so this needs to be attended to. This is somewhat horrible.
That's terrible.
I know, it's terrible. And then the first female governor of Maine has a woman full cabinet. We were just speaking about women's leadership, I believe, and this is Women's History Month, so she's got a cabinet.
Janet Mills.
Yes, yeah. Janet Mills, and that's we're honoring that. And we're talking about, you know, the casino, the bingo, rather, site at on Martha's Vineyard, and also interesting discussion about the red flag law in New Hampshire and how that was addressed. And then we're doing food and wine. Is there such a thing as vegan wine, Jim? Well, you'd need to find out.
I guess we will. By the way, you know, the tribe that has the bingo thing,
yes,
is now interested in opening a casino in southeastern Massachusetts.
No, two different tribes.
No, there are two. No, now that, there are two.
Well, I only knew that the one that is not, that has been in the fight for a while, that's separate from
I
the Aquina.
I know that, but okay. I think they've joined. I think the Aquina has also indicated an interest in the last couple of weeks.
Okay.
I believe that's
right.
True.
Okay.
Callie, we'll be
Callie,
listening.
Thank you very
great
much.
Great to see
right,
you. Thank you
right.
So much.
Okay. Callie Crossley's host of Under the Radar with
former
Callie
Girl
Crossley,
Scout,
which
too.
You can catch on Brownie, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. You can subscribe, to the Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Callie Crossley. Coming up in his amazing new book, Patrick Radin Keefe writes about the murder of 38-year-old Jean McConville, a mother of 10, as a way to tell the story of the bitter conflict in Northern Ireland and IRA atrocities. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie, and I am live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Marjorie is in Brighton, and she'll explain it someday, I guess. In his new book, New Yorker staff writer Patrick Radin Keefe writes about IRA atrocities. Along the way, he solves one of the most notorious crimes, the murder of Jean McConville, a mother of 10 living in Belfast. It's called Say Nothing, a true story of murder and memory in Northern Ireland. Tonight at 7 o'clock, you can catch Patrick at the Harvard Bookstore. And keeping with our tradition of trying to have only people from Dorchester on the show, Patrick Radin Keefe, welcome. We're glad to have you. The work is spectacular. We both loved it.
Thank you. I applaud this tradition.
I'm sure you do.
Congratulations, Patrick. I'm about 150 pages in. You've written an amazing, amazing book. So let's start by telling people that may not know what it was like in Belfast, Northern Ireland, in the time you write about, late 60s, early 70s, the so-called Troubles. What was going on there?
So just to remind folks who may not be as familiar with the history, you know, in the 1920s, you get the Irish War for Independence, and you end up with the partition of Ireland. So the country that we now call Ireland is, in fact, the southern part of that country, which is an independent state. And then in the north, there was this statelet, which was still controlled by the British, six counties controlled by the British. And in the north, it was a majority Protestant and minority Catholic. And for decades, there was a great deal of discrimination and not great civil rights for Catholics. A lot of people had to leave, which is part of the reason you end up with so many Irish in places like Boston. And during the 1960s, late 1960s, early 1970s, things come to a head, and you end up with a violent conflict between many different sides. You have the IRA, which is fighting basically for the reunification of Ireland. They want to get the British out. You've got loyalist paramilitary groups who are loyal to the British crown. You've got the police. You've got the British army comes in. And so really not that long ago, Belfast was an incredibly dangerous place, really racked by a pretty agonizing guerrilla war.
Well, you talk about, too, people's homes being bombed, people's homes on fire, Catholics with no place to live. You talk about this, one of your main characters in that famous incident in the bridge, which I can't pronounce.
Berntollet, yeah.
Yes. Tell people about that, where they were trying the nonviolent Martin Luther King, let's just march along, and what happened to these people that were protesting what was happening and the kind of attack they met.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I mean, the way I first came to this topic, you know, I grew up in Dorchester in a fairly Irish-American area, but I was only really distantly aware of the Troubles growing up. And I came into this in 2013 because a woman named Dolores Price died, and there was an obituary that I read for her, and she had lived this fascinating life. and became one of the central figures in this book. So she'd grown up in an IRA family, going back generations on both sides. Her family had been in the IRA, and her parents really raised her from childhood to believe, you know, you have a duty to expel the British by force. And it's kind of uncanny when you hear about her childhood. I mean, she would sit on her father's lap, and he would tell her when she was a little girl the ingredients for mixing improvised explosives, and he would really kind of encourage her to pursue that kind of life. But it was the 60s, and she was inspired, like a lot of young people were, actually by the American Civil Rights Movement. They saw the Selma March, and they thought, maybe there's another way. So she sort of rebels against her parents, she and her sister, Marion. And they say, we're going to go on this peaceful march from Belfast to the city of Derry over several days, and we're going to protest for better civil rights for Catholics, because peace is the way to do this. We're not going to use the traditional IRA techniques of violence. They go on this march, and everything's great for the first 3 days, and on the fourth day, they get ambushed by a loyalist mob and beaten up. And these two sisters end up going back to Belfast. They show up at the doorstep of their mother, who, remember, had raised them to believe the IRA was the way to go. And their mother takes one look at them, kind of bruised and battered, and she has one question. Why didn't you fight back? And at that point, Dolores Price becomes the first woman to join the IRA as a full frontline soldier. You know, she leads bombing missions, and she very much kind of returns to her parents' tradition of the full force tradition.
You know, you were talking about the Troubles a minute ago, Patrick, and explaining it to people who have been on the periphery of this. I think most people listening, I want to get back, obviously, to Jean McConville and Price in a second. Most people here know about the Good Friday Agreements 20-plus years ago, and I think naively a lot of us said, well, peace was declared. But is it fair to say from reading your work, we go from capital T Troubles to lowercase Troubles, I guess you might say. What's Belfast like today, 21 years after this deal?
I mean, this was the most striking thing for me as an American who'd, you know, I'd been over to Ireland for fun. But I didn't have a real appreciation for this. As I had known about this landmark peace deal, the Troubles End in 1998, which people probably remember, and I had a little bit of a sense that everything had come up roses. And you go there today, and it is an incredibly brittle peace. You have huge tension between these different communities. You've got what they call peace walls, which are like, they look like fences in a zoo between the Protestant and Catholic neighborhoods, separating them. 92% of school kids in Northern Ireland go to schools that are segregated by religion. So it's peaceful. It's a vast improvement on what was there before. But these tensions have not subsided.
So tell us about Jean McConville.
Yeah, okay. So the you know, I mentioned that I got started on this project reading this obituary of this fascinating woman, Dolores Price. One of the details in that obituary was that she was linked to the disappearance and murder of a woman named Jean McConville. And this actually became sort of the idea for this book. I wanted to tell the story of these two women and see if you could tell a larger story about the Troubles by looking at their experiences. So Dolores Price is in the IRA. Jean McConville was just a civilian. She was a mother of 10. She was a widow. Her husband had recently died. And in December 1972, she's at home one night with her kids when a gang of people bursts into her apartment in a housing complex in West Belfast. And they drag her out, and her kids are clinging to her legs screaming. This gang, they're masked, they have guns, and they say, we just want to talk to your mother, we'll bring her back. We'll bring her back in a few hours. But they never do. The mother never comes back. And the children end up in this apartment thinking, we got to stay here, because at some point our mother's going to come back. And she never does. And they don't know what happened to her. And rumors eventually came out that she'd been taken away and murdered by the IRA. But the kids didn't know for sure, and there was no body. And this was actually pretty unusual in Northern Ireland. You know, if you look at conflicts in places like Chile or Argentina, thousands and thousands of people, they call it forced disappearance, where you don't just kill somebody, but you erase them. Their family doesn't know what became of them. There's no body to bury. It happened only about a dozen and a half times over the whole course of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, but Jean McConville is perhaps the most famous example.
We're talking to Patrick Radin Keith. The book is Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. You paint a very grim picture of their life, too, living in this pretty horrible housing complex, very poor. As you say, her husband's dead. She's depressed. She's taking pills and having a very difficult time. But you also talk about that she was suspected of being informant. Now, I haven't finished the book yet, but at the point I'm at, what I learned was that there was a British soldier that had been shot right outside her door, and she just put a pillow under his head. And then the next day, there was graffiti on the door of her apartment saying, which made me wonder if this is maybe the only reason she was killed or if she was an informant. I don't know.
Yeah, well, so that's, it's one story, you know, I spent the last 4 years working on this book, and I went up back and forth to Belfast. I made 7 trips over there, and I spent time talking with Jean McConville's children. And one story that they remember about their mother is not long before she was taken away, there was this incident where they were in this housing project at night, and this was in Catholic West Belfast. The IRA was pretty heavily dug into this place. And it was late at night. You know, at night at that time, you stayed in the middle of the apartment. There was gunshots everywhere. It was a very dangerous scene. So the whole family would sleep on the floor in the middle of the apartment. And they suddenly hear this moaning sound. And Jean goes to see what's happening. And there's a British soldier who's been shot and wounded right outside their door. And one of her kids actually says, "Don't get involved in this." And what she says to him is, "That's some mother's son out there." And so she goes out and she brings the kid, the soldier, a pillow. And the next morning, there's graffiti daubed on the wall, and it says, "Brit lover." And what the IRA maintained when they, which they eventually did, when they acknowledged taking away Jean McConville and killing her, is that she was an informant for the British Army. Now, her kids to this day very strenuously resist that characterization, say, "Come on, she was a mother of 10, she was a widow. How is she going to be some super spy?" The IRA maintains that she was in this area where there was a lot of Republican activity, and she would have been in a position to know things. And it is true that the British Army often did take advantage of local people who were, you know, hard up, might have needed cash, needed help, and got them to feed them information.
By the way, and I'm sure people listening, or many people, remember that Gerry Adams was arrested, what, in 2014, 15-something?
Yep.
Around this murder and ultimately released, and he doesn't even acknowledge that he's in the IRA
at all.
Which is really, you know, just one connecting the past to the present or close to the present. You tell the story I've heard you tell in some interview a couple of days ago about Michael Mickey McConville riding in a cab years later, which is one of the most chilling things I've ever heard. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, this is part of what's so strange about this story. You know, you get these 10 kids. Their mother gets taken away. And they didn't know what happened to her. They're all distributed to different orphanages. And part of what was awful is some of these kids were so young that they don't even really have a vivid recollection of their mother. They remember a few things. There's one photo of her that survives, and they remember that. But some of them couldn't even really recall her face apart from that photo. But they do remember the people who took her away. And the strangeness of Belfast after the Troubles is everybody's still living there. In this very close, tight little city, much smaller than this one. It's very intimate. So I tell a story in the book that Michael McConville, Jean McConville's son, told me. He was 11 when his mother was taken away. And as an adult, some years back, he was in Belfast, and he flagged a black taxi. He gets into the back seat of the cab. The cab pulls away from the curb. He looks in the mirror, and he sees the driver's face, and he realizes that the guy driving the cab is one of the people who took his mother away in 1972.
I can't even...
You know, just we don't want to give away the whole story here, but just give us an idea of the connection between Jean McConville and Dolores Price.
Well, so Dolores Price was it turns out, was involved in this disappearance. And one of the things I wanted to do in the book was... in a way, approach this more like, less like a history of the Troubles and more like you would a novel, and just tell the story of, you know, 6 characters, real people, who went through this, and they're complicated people, and they interact in different ways, and look at this incident where Jean McConville's taken away and killed, and look at the impact not just on her family, but also on the people who carried it out. So Dolores Price was one of those people who was involved in this, and interestingly enough, after the Troubles ends... Here's the Boston angle. Boston College decides that they want to commemorate this period of time, and they want to get people, paramilitaries from both sides, to come in and talk about the things that they did during the Troubles. And so they set up an oral history project. But it has to be a secret oral history project, because if the cops knew in Belfast that you had people coming in and talking about, you know, murders they committed or bombs they set off, they would use those to go after people. So it's this top secret project. These people come in and talk. Dolores Price talks. Some other people who are in the IRA with her talk. And some of these people talk about what happened to Jean McConville. And some of them suggest that the person who ordered the abduction and murder of Jean McConville was Gerry Adams. So 2010, 2011, word leaks out that there's this secret archive at Boston College. And
which most people at Boston College didn't even know.
Didn't even know about. This was so secretive that, I mean, and I think...
The Belfast Project, is that what it's called?
It's called the Belfast Project. Yeah. The history department at Boston College didn't know anything about this. The fear that the word would leak out was so pronounced that I think in some ways, you know, you had too small a community of people who knew about this. But the word does leak out. And eventually, the police in Northern Ireland contact the U.S. Department of Justice and say, hey, could we subpoena that archive? Because we think there might be evidence in there that Gerry Adams ordered a murder. So it all unravels in pretty spectacular fashion.
Patrick, we're talking to Patrick Rodden Keefe, his book, Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. I just have two last things before you go. Can we stay in the present again? We talk to Charlie Sennett from the Ground Truth Project every week, and almost every week we talk about this hard Brexit that might be right around the corner. The potential for this fragile piece to get even more fragile is great, depending on what happens with Brexit. Is that not a fair statement?
Yeah, I would go a step further and say it's not even depending on what happens. I mean, there is no plan right now on the table for Brexit in just a few weeks that the British government will accept, seems likely to accept, which doesn't involve the reintroduction of some kind of a border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. If you're going to have...
Because Northern Ireland was a stay.
Wants to stay.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, Northern Ireland didn't want to stay. They voted against. But overall, yes,
right.
The UK is
going
to stay. And so you're going to have the only land border between the UK and the EU is going to run right through Ireland. But it's also, you got to remember, during the Troubles, the border was the ultimate icon of kind of, you know, all of these problems. You got sandbags, you got guys with guns, and you got snipers in South Armagh taking pot shots at British soldiers who were there. So I have yet to see a plan that it looks like the British would accept that doesn't involve some kind of reinscribing of that border. And I think, look, there's a lot of alarmism about this, and I tend not to be extremely alarmist about it. There's no way we're going to get a return to 1972, to the bad old days. But will we see some violence and a real ratcheting up of those tensions? I think inevitably we will.
Do they feel that way in Belfast? Is this just an outsider?
People are so worried about this. It is all they talk about.
Can I, for the final minute, if it's okay with you, Marjorie, I was mentioning to you before Rayford came on the air, I remember reading your incredible pieces about the late, great Anthony Bourdain in Vietnam. I remember, I think, you riding on the back of his Vespa.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Can you give us a minute on your recollections of Bourdain, if you don't mind?
Yeah.
Better?
I had had, a few years ago, I had had a stretch where I wrote a couple of very depressing pieces. I covered the Boston Marathon bombing trial for 6 weeks and wrote a piece about that, and I wrote a big piece about the Lockerbie bombing. And after that, my boss said, you know, we need to give you some R&R here. What do you want to do? And I told him my ultimate dream would be to spend a year, because that's what we do with The New Yorker. We go deep, hang out with Anthony Bourdain and traveling with him and write a big profile. And so I hung out with him for a year, and we went to Vietnam. I was there with him when he met Obama. And it's funny, if you read the piece now, it's a little strange because there's some darkness there. I mean, it's not that I had any inkling of what would happen, but you could tell there was a dark strain in him. But that moment you're talking about, which to me was one of my favorites, was at one point he said to me, you know, I'm gonna go on my Vespa and just ride around Hanoi. You want to hop on the back? And I hopped on. He had one helmet. He gave it to me. I'm like holding on. He just loved it, getting lost in the crowd. And it was the happiest I saw him.
It's unbelievable. Your book's unbelievable, too. Patrick, it's great
thank
to meet you.
You.
Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And congratulations again. It is terrific. Patrick Rodden Keefe is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. Tonight, you can catch him at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 o'clock, I believe. Is it 7
it
o'clock?
It is. 7 o'clock.
O'clock.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in, Patrick.
Thank you both.
And congratulations. Up next, it is our Friday news quiz. I'm very distraught because it's the women from Blackbird Donuts. And donuts are my favorite thing. They're next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I'm live at our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Marjorie's back in Brighton. It's time for our Friday news quiz. We're getting our afternoon donut fix by way of Black Bear Donuts. It opened its fourth gourmet donut shop, I think just yesterday. Am I not right about that? In Brighton, near our studios.
That's right.
We're joined by Erin Connor. Erin is the general manager of Blackbird Donuts. Great to meet you, Erin. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Rebecca Roth-Gullo of the Gullo Group. She's the owner of Gallo's Restaurant, Blackbird Donuts, and Banyan Barn Refuge. Rebecca, it's great to see you again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Marjorie, before you ask your first question, why don't you explain to these two women the first thing you said to me when we spoke on the phone this morning when you said you couldn't make it to the library studio. Go ahead.
I'm feeling a little bit guilty because I know that the new Blackbird Donuts is right down the street from our studio here, so I can just zip over there. I believe you're open until 4 o'clock right
However,
after the show.
Go ahead.
But I did say to Jim, can you please, I can see Justin arranging them right now, can you bring me a couple of donuts because I've heard great things about Blackbird Donuts and donuts are my favorite food in the world. So do a good job with that, Jim.
I'll do my, what's an artisanal donut there, and what does artisanal mean?
So for us, artisanal donuts, we use scratch ingredients. We put lots of thoughts and seasonality into our flavors and really try to make like a well-rounded menu that will serve people that really want classics, but also serve people that really want new, modern stuff.
You know, I read about you, Erin. You go from fine dining to donuts? I mean, how do you explain that transition?
I hatched a crazy idea in my head when I was in culinary school that I wanted to open my own donut shop. And after years of fine dining, I was like, hey, I'm looking for a change. I'm going to give this a try. Thought I'd do it for 6 months. Met this awesome lady and have been there for over 3 years.
You're in the promised land.
Yeah, it's the greatest.
Yeah, you told it. Where did this, what's the genesis of this? Where did this come from?
I started Blackbird when I was pregnant with my second child, and I needed a new project. And I thought that donuts were super easy and fun to work with. And it turns out that they are unbelievably complicated and very difficult and amazing to make.
Well, I have food in my mouth. You're not supposed to talk on the
okay.
radio. You have food in your mouth.
But wait. Something.
No, I got to ask you.
Okay. What,
this
Go
is
ahead.
Not your typical donut. What is it that I'm eating that's got all kinds of non-donut-y but fabulous taste? What is this thing?
So Sarah? You're eating our everything bagel donut.
Is that really what it is?
That's exactly what it is. So donuts are very similar to bagels in the idea that
really
the
good.
Dough is sweet. Because a bagel has malt in it and a little bit of sugar, and our donuts are made with brioche, so it is a little bit sweet, and what makes it sweet is the glaze, and so it lends itself to savory applications.
It's fabulous.
So what is it with us and donuts? I mean, you know, American donuts. I suppose other countries, they might have their croissant or whatever. I haven't traveled around the world that much, but we are really a donut nation, I think, aren't we?
Donuts have been around since biblical times.
They have?
Yep.
I did not know that.
There has been a fried product around since biblical times. If you look to any nation, they've got some sort of fried product, whether it's in China where they have fried donuts, and to Israel, they have a fried product. You look at beignets, you look at lots of things. So they've always been around, and so has yeast. So it makes sense.
You know, unfortunately, while there are people here at the library, the vast majority of people listening are at home or in their car, in their office. Erin, can you just give me a sense? Describe a couple of these. They are beautiful, but how they look is only part of it. Describe a little bit about what's lying on that platter there.
Okay, so we've got a full selection of our winter menu here, which is personally usually my favorite because it's got all of my favorite ones to eat.
What are they?
So marshmallow coconut is one of my absolute favorites. This one was inspired by the Hostess Snowball. So I wanted to eat one, so we figured out how to make our own version of it. And it's coconut milk and marshmallow fluff and a little desiccated cocoa on top. We also have our signature Boston cream, which is definitely a fan favorite, house-made pastry cream filling with real vanilla beans in it, and our not-too-sweet chocolate glaze, which really, like, rounds it out really nicely. We also have a super New England-y inspired flavor, the Purple Cow, based on Purple Cow ice cream, so, like, black raspberry and chocolate chips.
What's the hottest? What's the thing that... Is there one that stands out in terms of everybody ordering the thing when they come in?
Vanilla glazed.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That, you could get me that one, Jim.
I will. I will do it. You know, can I? Before we start this quiz, Rebecca, I actually have a long memory, And last time you were here, we were not just talking about Blackbird. We were talking about your restaurants. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking you, I don't think Marjorie was here that day. I think it may have been Jared. But in any case, I asked you, why is Gallows named Gallows? And I don't know if you're aware, you refused to answer my question. And lo and behold, I'm looking at research last night for your arriving today. And I see you do some interview with some publication in which you give this unbelievably great explanation as to why it has its name. So can you share it with us now? I'd love this.
I'd be happy to. I actually learned about the history of the gallows in this library.
Is that true?
I spent 3 months researching names for the restaurant, and I spent it upstairs main room. So the story is that Washington Street is known as the neck of Boston because it was the main road that would connect South Boston to Roxbury mm-hmm. in the original days back in the 1600s. And so we thought it was apropos, since Washington Street ran through us, that we would be called the Gallows. It also happens that the Gallows was located kitty corner to our location, and they used to hang people there, so it was a place to welcome you into our city as well. We are the Gallows, a fun place to hang, and we'll be 9 years old in 2 months.
Fun place to hang, a throwaway line. Okay, because I want to say one more thing.
What?
Since we are, well, Marjorie's not lucky enough unless I bring her some.
What is this thing I'm about to eat? Vanilla glaze?
Okay, I'm going to bite that in a minute. I'll tell Marjorie how good it is. Did I not read somewhere that you're giving out mini whatevers in Brighton? Am I right about that this weekend?
We are, yeah.
What's the deal with that?
Giving out miniature versions of the Blackbird, our signature donut. So it's a vanilla bean cake donut with vanilla glaze. Super traditional, but so delicious. And we're doing mini ones out of our Brighton location to kind of welcome everybody to our new home.
And great, by the way, where too. In Brighton are you? Tell people.
So we're on, our technical address is on Holton Street. We are on the back of that building. So if you go there, drive around, and you'll...
Isn't that where the Star Market's?
Right, yeah. Near,
yeah.
We're right behind there.
Right behind the Star Market.
100 Holton Street.
Okay, that great big huge Star Market that's got a bunch of stores. There's a bunch of other stores over there too, I think. Home Goods and stuff. Isn't that the same place?
It's across the street.
Across the street. Okay, perfect.
Marjorie will be there for her free donuts tomorrow.
Okay. Well, you know, they're open till 4, right?
You're
open till 4, correct?
Correct.
Okay. I have time, Jim.
Okay, who do you want to start with?
I'll start with Aaron. You ready, Aaron?
I am.
Everybody gets these wrong, so don't worry, but they're multiple choice.
Perfect.
Okay. Why was the once mighty video rental store Blockbuster making headlines this week? A, Blockbuster is doing a video rental pop-up Manhattan on Saturday in honor of their appearance in the 90s-based movie Captain Marvel, which is out this week. Or B, an ingenious entrepreneur bought 200 former Blockbusters and turned them into new countrywide locksmith stores called Lockbuster, saving millions in neon sign costs. Or C, the last Blockbuster in Australia announced they will be closing, making the Blockbuster in Bend, Oregon, the last in the world.
Gonna have to go with C.
You are
ding,
correct.
Ding, ding. Did you know that, or was that a wild guess?
No, we actually, one of my coworkers and I were talking about this yesterday,
whoa.
And he told me that the last one was in Alaska, so he was wrong.
Okay, fine. By the way, the vanilla, whatever it is really good, Marjorie. Let me just tell you
vanilla,
right now.
Vanilla bean glaze? Vanilla
yes.
beans, that's what it is? Okay.
The glaze experience.
Okay,
okay, so this is for you, Rebecca. Rebecca, President Trump, apparently confused by other people's habit of calling him Mr. President, got a little mixed up this week when he also referred to someone by what they do for work. Did he, A, call Apple CEO Tim Cook Tim Apple? Did he call the late Playboy founder Hugh Hefner Hugh Boobies? Or C, did he... I can't believe I said this. By the way, I didn't write this. Blame my staff, my coworkers. Or C, refer to former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort as Paul Crimes. Is it A, is it Tim Cook, Hugh whatever, or Paul Crimes? A, B, or C, Rebecca?
It should be all of the above,
but
it's A.
It is A. And by the way, if you've not seen the video, Tim Cook is sitting next to him, and he just matter-of-factly says, we want to thank you for what you're doing for America, Tim Apple. In any case, it is 1-1 at the end of one round there.
I can see that, though. That's the kind of mistake I'd make. I'd do something like that.
Can I, before we get to round two, Rebecca, this is for you, since you're the boss, the owner. Are you not in a place where, you know, everybody says Dunkin' Donuts, whatever. You're on your fourth, and it sounds like with the huge space you have in Brighton, you plan mm-hmm. to expand beyond that. What's the niche that you successfully identified that allows people to say, I'll try these artisanal donuts, these special donuts, as opposed to the other thing that we've grown up with in this neighborhood? What's the deal?
We love Dunks. Let's be
we do?
Super clear about it. We enjoy it. We
yep.
get it. We
However,
have no... But Dunk's is really a coffee business. I mean, 90% of their business is drinks, not donuts, and we happen to be the exact opposite. So it's just a treat that people enjoy, and we're used to spending $3 to $4 on pastries. You buy a croissant for $4, you buy a cookie, you get all things like that. So I think that there's, I mean, we know that there's a great love for it, and people want something that is going to be homemade from organic ingredients, and they enjoy it.
I'm right, by the way. Your Brighton thing is huge, right? And it's obviously not huge just as a retail outlet. It's huge because you're going to make them there and expand. Yes,
yeah, it's 5,600 square feet, so it's close to 8 times larger than our principal store in Tremont Street in the South End.
Okay, round two, Marjorie Egan.
Okay, here we go, Aaron. This week, the headlines brought us to Sweden, where we learned that retail giant IKEA had rolled out what very on-brand product this spring. A, they're releasing a chocolate Easter bunny, but it comes in 3 pieces and you have to assemble it yourself. Or B, they're offering free counseling for couples who break up while picking out furniture. Or C, they're filling the ball pit at Smalland with their signature Swedish meatballs.
Were you discussing this at work yesterday, too?
Unfortunately not. That would have been helpful. I'm going to guess A.
You are right.
Wow, you were on fire there. It's
I would have thought it was the Swedish meatballs. Jim, imagine that. You would have just flown right there right for the weekend.
You know, Marjorie, you are really losing out, let me just say. They smell really good, too.
Yeah.
Well, what's that white thing with the brown stuff, like on the other end of the – that? What's that thing? Put your down. Yeah, what is that thing?
That one?
Yeah.
So that's mint chocolate. So it's our dark chocolate cake donut that's made with 100% jet black cocoa, which has like a really beautiful bitterness to it. And then it's a mint glaze and then Andes candies on top. And I will just say one thing about the Andes.
Please.
Our Blackbird staff – we buy cases of Andes, and they unwrap every single individual candy to make this happen. So it's a special one for us.
Okay, I'll bring you one of those too, Marjorie. So here is question four. This is your opportunity before the bonus round, Rebecca, to tie things up. You ready? Yes, I am, Jim. In this week's edition of Don't Quote Me, who is the real person behind this quote? It offers space to sit, to stand, to lie down. Oh, this is the quote. I'm sorry. It offers space to sit, to stand, to lie down. Who said it? In describing the huge bong Snoop Dogg gave to Martha Stewart to mark her entry into the cannabis business, he said it offers space to sit, to stand, to lie down. B, in describing the size of Cheesecake Factory's brownie bowl, food writer Corby Kummer, a regular on our show, said it offers space to sit, to stand, to lie down. Or C, in describing the cages that children of the border live in, Homeland Security Secretary before Congress Kirstjen Nielsen said it offers space to sit, to stand, to lie down. Is it A, B, or C?
Unfortunately, it is C.
It is unfortunately. And by the way, on a serious note, which we usually don't do during the quiz, if you have not listened to the nauseating testimony of this woman, go Google it this weekend and see how we treat kids. In our name, these kids are being treated that way. So it is 2-2, ladies. And in the bonus round, since you asked, now that you open a new outlet in Brighton, we'll make sure you know your stomping grounds. This week's bonus round is all about the neighborhood where Marjorie's broadcasting out of right now. That would be Brighton, Massachusetts. That should be excellent.
Okay. You ready?
Are they ready?
We're ready.
So I'm going to switch it up now. I'm going to switch. I'm going to go with Rebecca.
Rebecca, yeah, you're doing Rebecca.
Okay, here we go.
Good.
This Brighton native is a staple of Massachusetts politics and was once called, quote, the Prince of Darkness, unquote, for taking walks throughout the State House dark corridors during the late night legislative sessions. Who is it? It's former Governor Deval Patrick. B is Secretary of State Bill Galvin, or C is Congressman Stephen Lynch.
B.
You are correct.
Was that a guess or a real thing?
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
I worked in the State House
at one point in my life. What did you do in the State House?
Well, I passed a bill in 1985 to make the corn muffin the state muffin of Massachusetts.
Was it really? You're the one?
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. You work on the big issues.
My food, very, very important.
Congratulations on
that. Is the corn muffin the state muffin of Massachusetts?
Ding, ding, ding. You're
correct. She gets a half a point on that, actually. That is fabulous.
You know what I wonder from you?
Why she was
you,
doing it is another donut whole
ladies.
Story.
Why did Krispy Kreme?
Donut ladies.
Why did Krispy Kreme flop? Remember how excited we were about Krispy Kreme, Jim, years ago when they were coming to Boston?
I do remember. We did shows
and they didn't last at all.
Horrible.
They were supposed to like take over the donut business in Massachusetts, put everybody out of business, Dunkin' Donuts, etc. And they lasted.
I can answer. Am I allowed to answer and then see if they agree?
Please.
Remember the light went on, little red light saying they're ready. And if you ate them from the store, they were great and warm. If you took them home, they tasted like you know what. Is that a fair explanation of what happened, or am I wrong?
I think that that's accurate, okay. But it's also when you compete against dunks, which we are not trying to do.
No, we're not.
You're never going to win.
Yeah, this is
in
dunks
Massachusetts.
Country.
This is this is dunks country.
Okay, fine. Now you are losing by 1 point, Erin, but you are one question behind, so you can tie it up. Oh, I can 1.5 because she got the corn muffin. We'll give you a half question too.
Okay.
If you're hanging out in Brighton, you might spot Captain America star Chris Evans walking around. He's filming a new TV show called Defending Jacob, which is what? A, the story of a lawyer's life changes when his son is accused of stabbing a classmate. B, a thriller set in the 1980s Boston about an intrepid cub reporter working for the Boston Herald.
Oh, my gosh.
Or C, a tough-as-nails Cambridge public defender with a heart of gold who lands the case of a lifetime. Is it A, is it B, or would it be C?
I'm going to guess A.
Wow. You haven't gotten anything wrong
yet. You guys are unbelievable.
Wow. This is amazing.
This is very impressive. Do we have time for one more?
We do, and this will decide who goes home the winner. This is huge,
okay.
Marjorie.
Rebecca, this is a question.
Good luck to you.
Here we go. Your new shop is technically in Brighton, but some locals might say you're actually located in Austin, which they also call what? A, Austin Rat City. B, home of the greatest grilled cheese sandwich this side of the Mississippi. Or C, Boston University's third campus.
A, B, or C?
C.
Oh, this is your chance, Erin. Now, of course, you'd be beating the boss, which is not really a good thing. But go ahead. What's the correct answer?
Is it A?
Yes. You go home.
That's terrible.
Oh, they're still friendly. They high-fived each other. So how do we find you guys? Tell us where all the locations are one more time, please.
So we are in the South End on Tremont and Berkeley Street. Yeah. We are in Fenway on Kilmarnock in the Target building. You can find us at the Smith Campus Center in Harvard Square, 1350 Mass Ave. And now you can find us in Brighton at 100 Holton Street in the backside.
You look like the most relaxed person I've ever seen. Are you as relaxed, Rebecca, as you appear?
Well, I was at a penguin breakfast for one of my daughters this morning.
Okay.
I've been running around.
So as compared to that, this is relaxing.
This is easy.
Congratulations. Donuts are fabulous. Thanks so much for bringing
them. Is it hard for you not to eat all the donuts?
Who says I'm not going to eat it? Oh, you're talking about them?
Yes.
I eat at least one donut a day.
Oh, that's
one?
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's okay. Very moderate and in control. Thank you very much.
It's great
I'm
to
sorry
see
I didn't get to meet you in person, but Jim, don't forget the donut.
Erin
Connor is
the donuts,
general manager
Margaret.
Of Blackbird Donuts. Rebecca Roth, Gallo runs the Gallo Group. She's the owner of Gallo's Restaurant, Blackbird Donuts, and Bayon Bar and Refuge. Thank you so much for coming in and for bringing Jim and our staff all the donuts.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for our politics roundup, Charlie Sennett on the latest global headlines, and the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price for All Revved Up. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Mers, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer John LaClaw Parker, our on-site engineers. Today, I don't know, is David there? I don't know who the other on-site engineers are. I apologize.
Oh, yeah. Okay, my apologies.
Special thanks to the folks at the Newsfeed Cafe, and thank you to everybody that came down to the Boston Public Library. Jim is not on TV tonight.
No, so I guess
we don't have to worry
you
about you.
You didn't come to the library. Well, you do have to worry about me, because Marjorie and I are narrating. We're doing something we haven't done before on Sunday at All Saints Parish in Brookline, near where Marjorie lives. She and I are narrating a performance of the Metropolitan Chorale Sunday at 3, again, All Saints Parish. It is about the role of music as an agent of change in everything from civil rights movements, the Baltic Singing Revolution, the Holocaust, all these incredible moments in history, and the program is spectacular. I hope you'll come, and if you want to get tickets, you go to Metropolitan Chorale. It's chorale.org, metropolitancorale.org. Sunday at 3 in Brookline, we'll be there. David Cleckley is the engineer about who you were speaking,
yeah,
about whom you
sorry
were speaking.
About that.
Marjorie. Marjorie, we missed you today, but I guess if you want the donuts, you better come find me,
okay.
Don't you think?
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again on Monday and have a wonderful weekend.